People of the power, people of the power, people of the power. Hello, everybody. Thought that was an appropriate transition. Appropriate transition from the conference call we're just on.
I want to bring.
Whoops, there we go. We want to play one more right now, just because. That was done the last time the Dalai Lama was here. All the llamas were in the background standing on the stage behind Patty. That's pretty wild. It just reminds me that, the Dalai Lama is going to be here for 3 solid weeks. He's going to be going to talk to children and talk to all the different levels. And, you know, that was at a university in Seattle, as far as I remember. I still remember that. But I expect that, this is not a guessing game. The Dalai Lama doesn't show up here by invitation at this moment by Obama in the face of China saying boo, remembering that President Xi from China is working behind the scenes. Remember, there's mass programming. And this President Xi and this President Obama and this President Putin know it. And they all know that, like our friend Lynn was saying, releasing all the prisoners out into the world, oh, that's just great. all the powers that were made sure that there was no chance for the things that are needed to even be built. That despite the nose on our face, the Venus Project is here. Despite the nose of our face, the things that haven't been being talked about, all kinds of things have been developed. And there is something called a galactic realm that can literally show up. And I would not even think for one second, as the power is here. Ed, who developed the spherical structures, Ed Hicks, he's Metatron in a body, and he goes up and down on the ships just like Rama. You don't even know where he is. He told us the last time that we talked with him that he was going to have to disappear. He's been disappeared for a long time. Our friend Keith Olbermann, he said, I got to disappear for a while. He said, I'll be back. And he got onto Stephanie Miller's show on TV just a slight minute. I mean, barely after she got, when was that? Right before or after she got on Free Speech. But it's right before. It was just like she's only been on there for a couple of months. A month, maybe even only. I mean, time is flying when you're having a good time. Don't underestimate the possibility of the galactics literally manifesting all these light cities. In a sense, when the student is ready, the teacher arrives. Yes.
There is a lady, an elder in Sedona named Jeannie, and she is connected with building the light cities in Sedona, and she describes that the light cities are literally manifesting from the etheric onto the ground. And actually, there is a group of folks that have built in Sedona dome structures, spherical structures, egg structures. I mean, the egg structures look like right out of the movie, The Rise of the Guardian, when the the Easter Bunny shows up with Jack Frost.
Yeah, ladies and jelly beans, you can watch this movie right on your computer. You don't have to go anywhere. And you really should to just get that magic. And the way that we have had to grind through the resistance, and that was another thing that Carl Boudreau was saying in his astrology. He was saying the wind is not, you know, talking about lefty wind coming from the bottom up, from the grassroots, and that wind would just lift you from the bottom up. You better have the wings on your feet and the ones on your cap and the ones in your
Mercury.
Shoulders. Mercury is, yeah, Mercury. And actually, that's the next planet we're headed to. I mean, let's, time is not moving other than simulcast here. In other words, this, we have been forced in a way we asked for. We wanted to know how it was to deal with a third dimensional, like molasses, everybody resisting, everybody having this human lower thing of being cunning and self-destructive energy. And if we haven't learned one thing, we've learned this. That as we haven't learned anything at all, we've learned this. That's a better way to say it. Is that surrender is the word. Surrender is the word. Complaining, in a sense, is it comes from fear too. It still comes from fear because, again, you know, you sit there and you say, you're going to let everybody out, and then what? I mean, you're going to bring all the soldiers home, millions of them, when you get PTSD. From all the bases with PTSD and, you know, and gun sticks, fuck. you know, over half of the people that are homeless right now are vets. And the rest of the other half of the people that Reagan threw out on the streets from the mental institutions. Yeah, we are having galactic intervention. That is that. And don't be surprised. Again, we've got one little egg city with the domes and the saucers and the, you know, and the heliports and the saucer ports. I mean, we've got things that have been built with anti-gravity technology. We've got hovercraft, and I don't know, because none of us have been here before, except that I know that the best is yet to come is an overnight deal. And we, in order for that overnight deal to be real, it is necessary for us to go beyond the mechanisms that we have been learning how to master in old ways. And like Cynthia and Michael, when they worked together as a team and they worked with these veterans in Alabama every week, they saw people who were given up when the regular medical centers gave up and said, I give up, this person's going to have PTSD for the rest of his life. And they'd send them to Michael and Cynthia. And sometimes in 10 minutes, it was over. 10 minutes. And then these people, you know, you only need one Kundalini experience to have it. There is nobody that can tell you what it's like, and nothing afterwards can change your mind because you never forget it. That's what we're talking about here. And, yeah, you look at the 3D level and you walk into the ghetto, and if you can get through the ghetto and not be dead before you get out the other end, which I was absolutely incorrigible about, and it wouldn't been, I wouldn't have done it if it weren't that I knew, because my guides were saying, you have no money, you're sitting downtown at Loyola University Union, and you got to go to this one moment in time and show up, because there's a reason. And it was the last night before Martin Luther King took a plane to Memphis, Tennessee. Now, of course, everybody knows why. Yet I did show up, and I witnessed that there was a mole in the room. I wasn't quite sure who the mole was in the room at that night, but I happened to meet a few people along the road, and now I know, especially one sister from the Aboriginal Mobite Nation, who sat down and talked to me, only me was guided, even though there was all bunch of people around, took me to the side in the parking lot and showed me her clasp and the Martin Luther King picture in there, and then told me that she was holding Martin Luther King in his arms when he died on the lanai in Memphis, Tennessee. That was only 2 days after I showed up, after walking from downtown to the west side of Chicago through every thick, dense ghetto you could possibly dream up. And I walked through it from about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 o'clock at night. It took me that long to walk through that ghetto. It was dark. And I walked in just at the moment to get the whole setting that I needed to get and to get to know. I knew that, I knew that for some reason I had to get there. I didn't know it was going to be 2 days later that he wasn't going to be here anymore. That's the kind of twinkling of an eye that we're talking about here. And we're also talking about, you know, everybody still thinks they're going to die. Well, I don't.
No.
That doesn't mean that you're not going to die just because you don't think you're going to die. But what it does mean is that you're not going to live unless you actually do something to follow up on that. When you become aware of something, when you show up, this is why it's so important to keep these group energy of this radio connection that we have been doing at the price of $300 a week, which is a deal. There is nobody getting it for that price. And the reason it's getting it for that price is because this is a donation basis. We are not doing one single thing here for profit. We're not even in the system.
We're not even the 501c3.
No, none of that stuff. What I'm saying right now is that the difference is so, when that lead balloon is around the neck, and it's not around the neck, and that's a matter of consciousness. In other words, that lead balloon called the powers that were literally isn't around our neck anymore, but for all the consciousness of the people, unconscious, ignorant, holding on to that lead balloon that goes with it, it's that quick. And it only took 10 minutes for a person that was given up, that was psychotic, was suicidal, was absolutely obsessed with the possession of darkness, and that is gone. Now there's steps beyond that, yet we have been told, and I know it's true, that though it appears that it's not where we think it is, it is. And the believing in the magic and following up with that is the key. So let's just play this next song, our sister Odetta, who is no longer on this planet either, but this is called This Little Light of Mine, but she's going to share something with us before. Let's just listen to her.
I want to bring to you something about you. It is a quote. I quote, "Our worst fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God within us. It is not just in some of us. It is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. This is with gratitude to Marianne Williamson, everybody. There's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. There's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. There's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Yes, there's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. Shine. Oh, there's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. There's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. May we know that together. There's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. Mama, there's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. There's a little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Everywhere I go, everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine, oh, everywhere I go. I'm gonna let it shine, everywhere I go. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
All in my room, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my room, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my room.
Ghetto road with good vibration and get your way home. It does work. It does. No, I thought we were going to do that. I thought we were going to do Julian Assange. Do you want to do Julian Assange? Huh? What, you want to do that? Well, I thought we agreed just before we were going to let it go. Which one do you want to do? There's so many things that we want to play, but okay. the balance is what Libra is about. And Lady Master Mott is about that too. And do not think for one moment that the Galactics aren't here. Rama got to talk to the Dalai Lama with the King of Swords, and he said one thing. He said, "Hello, Lord Rama. Your father is here." And they are in orbit. And he said they are in orbit. What we know is there are trillions of light ships in orbit around this planet right now. And this planet in particular right now, becoming the 33rd planet to enter into the Federation of Worlds, doesn't mean it's going to take another eon for the 34th. It doesn't at all. This is what this horsey is doing in town, this Pegasus horsey. And with the wind beneath your feet and the wings beneath your feet of the eagle and the horsey. And so we're going to go to the other end of the balance and bring in where we've been and what's coming up to help us get through that in a very big way without these particular whistleblowers that we're talking about now. Lord knows where we would be going or where we'd get to. Let me just get there. So let me see. That was on, oh my goodness, everybody. Just let me pull it up here. Yeah, that's it. Nope, not that one. Okay, one more. Back up the truck. Okay, here we go. Now we... Okay, this, yeah, this is the Democracy Now. I didn't do until the afternoon time because, yeah. Yeah, okay. All right, here, Rama. Here we go. Okay.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Top secret documents leaked by Edward Snowden have revealed new details about how the United States and Britain targeted the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks after it published leaked documents about the Afghan war. According to a new article co-written by Glenn Greenwald, published this morning by The Intercept, Britain's top spy agency, the Government Communications Headquarters, or GCHQ, secretly monitored visitors to a WikiLeaks site by collecting their IP addresses in real time, as well as the search terms used to reach the site. One document from 2010 shows that the National Security Agency added WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange to a, quote, manhunting target list, together with suspected members of Al-Qaeda.
Another document reveals the NSA considered designating WikiLeaks as a malicious foreign actor. According to The Intercept, such a designation would have allowed the group to be targeted with extensive electronic surveillance without the need to exclude U.S. persons from the surveillance searches. In addition, the leaked documents reveal the United States urged its foreign allies to file criminal charges against Assange over the group's publication of the Afghanistan war logs. Joining us now from London is WikiLeaks founder and editor Julian Assange, talking to us by the phone from the Ecuadorian embassy, where he has political asylum since August 2012. Here in New York, we're joined by Michael Ratner, the attorney for Julian Assange, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. When you read this, Julian, welcome back to Democracy Now!, what were your thoughts on being put on this manhunting, their words, manhunting list together with Al-Qaeda?
Good morning, Amy. Well, my first thought was, well, finally we have some proof that we can present to the public for what we've long suspected for a variety of reasons. It is strange to see your name in that context with people who are suspected of serious terrorism. Clearly, that is a massive overstep. We've heard a lot in the propaganda pushed on this issue by Clapper and others in the U.S. national security complex that, of course, this pervasive surveillance is justified by the need to stop U.S. Stop the terrorist attacks being conducted on the United States and its allies. But we've seen example after example come out over the last few months showing the National Security Agency and its partners, GCHQ, engage in economic espionage. And here we have an example where the type of espionage been engaged in is spying on a publisher, WikiLeaks, the publishing organization, and a publisher, me personally. And the other material that came out in relation to GCHQ was from 2012. And that shows that GCHQ was spying on our servers and our readers. So not just the publisher as an organization, not just the publisher as a person, but also the readers of a publisher. And that's clearly, I believe, not something that the United States population agrees with, let alone other people.
Were you surprised by anything that came out in these latest documents?
I was surprised about how someone is added to the foreign malicious actor list. So the National Security Agency went through a process to try and at the quite a high level at the office of their legal director to designate us as a foreign malicious actor, which means that our U.S. personnel can be spied on, or our U.S. supporters or associates, the quote human network that supports WikiLeaks in the United States can be targeted without going through any of the checks that the National Security Agency might normally engage in. And if you read the detail of that writing, you can see that it's quite a lackadaisical cavalier approach to going into that very serious step of deciding to spy on a publisher and all its U.S. personnel. And we must assume that news agencies like Reuters or the Deutsche Press Agency that have foreign correspondents in the United States or American citizens or American citizens working overseas could be similarly affected.
Julian Assange, the Intercept article quotes from the document you're referencing. It was from July 2011 and showed how two NSA officers considered designating WikiLeaks a, quote, malicious foreign actor. I want to read from the exchange between the NSA agency's general counsel and an arm of its threat operations center. Quote, can we treat a foreign server who stores or potentially disseminates leaked or stolen U.S. data on its server as a malicious foreign actor for the purposes of targeting with no defeats? Examples, WikiLeaks, thepiratebay.org, etc. The response was, quote, let us get back to you. Julian Assange, your response and what the documents reveal about the process that the NSA or GCHQ go through to designate someone a malicious foreign actor.
What they mean here is by no defeats. It's sort of no protections for any form of interception of content of U.S. Citizens communicating with that organization or through that foreign server. And the particular document that this came out in was actually not a document that was formally looking at this issue in relation to us. Rather, it was a extraction from that consideration that happened sometime in the past and then was put into one of their, if you like, a sort of frequently asked questions internally in the National Security Agency. So we're quite lucky to have found this reference. We were used as an example of how could you, in fact, target these servers even when they were used by people in the United States. And the answer is yes, that can be done. And we don't know what the answer was in our particular particular case, but given that the general example is yes, then we must assume that it was. And I think really now General Alexander needs to come clean and say, in fact, was that permitted in the case of WikiLeaks, and did the National Security Agency proceed in spying on our US personnel or our lawyers, for example, like Michael Ratner, who's based in New York.
Julian, we have Michael here, but I did want to ask, you've been in the embassy, haven't had natural daylight sunlight for 608 days. How are you, and does the information that has come out of this change in any way what your thoughts are about your future?
Well, I just find it helpful that in preparing the asylum application, of course, we looked into many details like this. Were quite technical, a big puzzle of many pieces, which some organization like a foreign office or the Ecuadorian Department of Foreign Affairs has the time to assess, but of course it's harder for the public to understand it. But documents like this show very readily the sort of the scale of the U.S. Response to our publications and why it's unfortunately necessary for me to apply and receive asylum, and for some of our other personnel, like Sarah Harrison, who's a British citizen, to be in legally advised exile in Germany.
And will the information about whether there is a sealed indictment, which this seems to indicate there isn't, do you have any further information about that, an indictment against you in the United States?
The district attorney of Virginia gave the last information on that issue and formally stated publicly that the investigation continues.
Well, Julian Assange, I want to thank you for being with us, founder and editor-chief of WikiLeaks. Will this change anything you do inside the embassy when you see how further information about your being monitored and people even going to the website, what is it, GCHQ, the equivalent of the NSA in Britain, collecting the IP addresses in real time of people who even access the WikiLeaks site?
The WikiLeaks security model has always been predicated under the basis that we are dealing with very powerful organizations that do not obey the rule of law. Whether those are powerful criminal organizations, whether those are corrupt governments in Africa, or whether they're spy agencies allied with the West or Russia or China. And so it doesn't, we've always been prepared to defend against that sort of scrutiny. The UK government has publicly admitted that they've spent £6 million in the last year surveilling the embassy through police forces alone. We see from these documents that we must assume that GCHQ is also monitoring the situation. That's part of, I suppose, part of the sad state of the rule of law in the West, where these organizations behave that way. I think the days are clearly numbered that they can get away with it without being exposed. But I'll leave you to Michael Ratner now.
Thanks so much, Julian. Julian Assange, founder and editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks. When we come back, we are joined by Michael Ratner, legal advisor to Julian Assange. We'll also be joined from London, not in exile in the Ecuadorian embassy, but in a studio in London, by Jocelyn Radak, the legal advisor to Edward Snowden, who was stopped at Heathrow Airport on Sunday, asked, who is Edward Snowden? Where is Bradley Manning? And other such questions. Stay with us.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better stop swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, And keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times they are a-changing. Some senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that is hurt will be he who has sought.
Times They Are Changing by Bob Dylan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Top secret documents leaked by Edward Snowden have revealed new details about how the United States and Britain targeted the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks after it published leaked documents about the Afghan war. According to a new article written by Glenn Greenwald and Ryan Gallagher, published this morning by The Intercept, Britain's top spy agency, the Government Communications Headquarters, or GCHQ, secretly monitored visitors to a WikiLeaks site by collecting their IP addresses in real time, as well as the search terms used to reach the site.
One of the documents leaked by Edward Snowden details a manhunting timeline that shows how the U.S. tried to pressure other nations to prosecute Julian Assange. One read, quote, "The United States on August 10th urged other nations with forces in Afghanistan, including Australia, United Kingdom, and Germany, to consider filing criminal charges against Julian Assange." Joining us now is Michael Ratner. He is the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is the legal advisor to Julian Assange. So talk about this last point, Michael. First, what you're most surprised by in this piece that just came out at The Intercept, and particularly the U.S. pushing other countries to prosecute Julian.
Well, what I was really shocked by was the extent the U.S. and U.K. have gone through to try and get and destroy WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and their network of supporters. I mean, it's astounding, and it's been going on for years. And it also, as Julian pointed out, tells us why he is in the Ecuadorian embassy and why Ecuador has given him asylum. He has every reason to heavily fear what would happen to him in this country, in the United States, if he were to be ever taken here. So I think for me, that's a very, very critical point, justifies every reason why Ecuador gave him asylum. And the document you're addressing, Amy, what they call the manhunt timeline, which is extraordinary because it groups him among, you know, a whole bunch of people who the U.S. considers, you know, terrorists. It also interestingly groups them among Palestinians, which is pretty interesting in itself. But to have Julian on that list as a manhunt timeline, and it says prosecute him wherever you can get him, is pretty extraordinary. It doesn't say you necessarily need a good reason to prosecute him. It just says basically prosecute him. And what it's reminiscent to me is of the program that took place in this country in the 60s and the 70s, COINTELPRO, counterintelligence procedures, when the FBI said we have to basically destroy the black civil rights movement, the New Left and others, and prosecute them. Get them however you can. Get rid of them. And so the manhunt timeline, even its name is chilling, but that's what it is. It's an effort to try and get WikiLeaks and their personnel wherever they are in the world. And of course, we've seen some of that. You've had people on this show. When people cross borders who are associates with WikiLeaks, they get stopped. They get surveilled all the time. We've seen efforts to take to basically destroy WikiLeaks by stealing their laptops on a trip that went from Sweden to Germany. We've seen efforts across the board in country after country. Germany, they surveil conferences when WikiLeaks people speak there, everywhere. So actually, this program is not just an abstraction. This program has been implemented. And the manhunt timeline, I think, is incredibly significant, considering that the manhunt is an effort to locate, find, and destroy, in some cases, kill people.
And Michael Ratner, what do you think the appropriate response should be to something like that? Is there any legal action that Assange's legal team can take in response to this?
Julian Assange, in his statement to the article, said that he felt that the U.S. ought to appoint a special prosecutor, not just to investigate what's happening to WikiLeaks and a publisher and journalists, but across the board, what's happening to publishers and journalists in this entire country right now and around the world, where the U.S. is trying to basically say publishing is a crime. And that's what they're saying. That's what the Obama administration is saying. And he's Julian and is strongly suggesting, and I support the idea of a special prosecutor to look into this.
Is that aspect of it unprecedented, though? I mean, you drew comparisons between COINTELPRO and the Manhunt timeline, but the fact that publishing, people who work in journalism, are being monitored in this way by intelligence agencies here, has that occurred before?
On this level, I don't think it's occurred. On this extreme level, you had the Manhunt program. You also had what they call, the Anti-Crisis Girl Program, and that's the drag. I don't know why it got that name.
Anti-Crisis Girl Program.
What is that about? I mean, I don't know, except what it is whenever I search for WikiLeaks on my computer or when I go visit the WikiLeaks site, in real time, the GCHQ, the British Intelligence Agency, can take in my IP address, take in what I'm searching for in real time. Now, they gave a number of slides showing how they could do this. We don't know how extensively they've implemented that program, but that means that every one of us who've ever gone to a WikiLeaks site to look for a document could technically be surveilled and our IP address taken in.
Also, the hacktivist group Anonymous and Pirate Bay explained.
Well, Anonymous, they actually did designate as what they call a malicious foreign actor. And a malicious foreign actor, which is what they were deciding whether to designate WikiLeaks as or not, and we don't know what the final decision was, whether WikiLeaks was designated as a malicious foreign actor, but Anonymous apparently was. And what it means is any restrictions on government surveillance of anything, my conversations, my email, are completely lifted, whether you're an American or whatever. Any of my communications to anywhere in the world, to that website, to Anonymous, going on chat rooms with Anonymous, going on tweets with Anonymous, those can be taken in and surveilled. It's an incredibly broad power. We don't know, as I said, if it was used against WikiLeaks. It was certainly discussed, and they asked to use it against WikiLeaks. We will know, I hope, soon, if and when a lawsuit is ever filed around these issues.
And what do the documents reveal about what the U.S. officials said they were doing and what, in fact, they were doing? Because not only was there surveillance of U.S. citizens problematic, but also of foreign citizens.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not following the question.
In other words, Michael Ratner, the U.S. officials have claimed that they only surveil foreign citizens who are in some sense either potentially guilty of or likely to be involved in terrorist activities. But if you're monitoring every visitor to a website, whether it's WikiLeaks or Pirate Bay or not, I mean, that's obviously not
the case. This is just obfuscation and lies by our officials, which has been consistent. Obviously, if there's a WikiLeaks website overseas, what they're really saying is everybody who visits that website, American or otherwise, we can surveil. So it's complete BS. This is just untrue. We are all being surveilled.
Michael, we want you to stay with us as we bring in another guest from London. You know what I mean?
Four journalists who revealed the National Security Agency's vast web of spying have been awarded the 2013 George Polk Awards in Journalism. Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Ewan McCaskill of The Guardian, and Barton Gellman of The Washington Post were among the winners announced on Sunday, even as the journalists who broke the stories based on Snowden's leaks were awarded one of journalism's highest honors. A lawyer who represents Snowden was detained while going through customs at London's Heathrow Airport. Jesslyn Radack told Firedog Lake she was subjected to, quote, very hostile questioning about Snowden and her trips to Russia. Radack also learned she might be on an inhibited persons list, a designation reportedly used by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to require further vetting of certain passengers. After the Polk Awards were announced, Glenn Greenwald tweeted, quote, in the U.K. government, this is known as the George Polk Award for Excellence in Terrorism. Jesslyn Radack is just one of a growing number of people who are being stopped, harassed, and interrogated for their work around Edward Snowden, WikiLeaks, and National Security Agency documents. In this clip, we hear from journalist Laura Poitras, computer security researcher Jacob Applebaum, and then journalist Glenn Greenwald's partner David Miranda, who have all been stopped and interrogated in airports.
I've actually lost count to how many times I've been detained at the border, but it's I think around 40 times. And on this particular trip, lately they've been actually sending someone from the Department of Homeland Security to question me in the departing city. So I was questioned in London about what I was doing. I told them I was a journalist and that, you know, my work is protected and I wasn't going to discuss it.
I was targeted by the U.S. government. And essentially, until the last four times that I've flown, I was detained basically every time. Sometimes men would meet me at the jetway, similarly with guns.
I stayed in a room with three different agents. They were entering and exiting. They spoke to me, asking me questions about my whole life. They took my computer, my video game, cell phone, everything.
That was journalist Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda. Before him, computer security researcher Jacob Applebaum and journalist Laura Poitras. You can go to our website to see our interview with Jacob Applebaum and Laura Poitras at democracynow.org. But all of them have been interrogated at airports, as has most recently Jesslyn Radack, the attorney representing Edward Snowden, joining us from London. She's a former ethics advisor to the U.S. Department of Justice under George W. Bush, currently Director of National Security and Human Rights at the Government Accountability Project, the nation's leading whistleblower organization. Jesslyn, welcome back to Democracy Now! Describe what happened at Heathrow on Sunday.
I was trying to enter through customs, which at Heathrow is called the Border Force, and I was directed to a very specific station rather than the regular line. And after the first question, which is, why are you here, which is a normal question, things just got more bizarre as we went along. I said that I was here to see friends. They wanted me to be more specific. I said in the Sam Adams Association, the group that awarded Edward Snowden the award last year. I didn't add that part. And then they asked for the names of the people in the group. And so I gave names of people who are publicly known to be members. And then they asked where we were meeting. And I said at the Ecuadorian embassy, and they asked with Julian Assange. And I said yes. But then at that point, I was asked why I had been to Russia twice in the past 3 months. And I said, because I have a client there. And they asked who, and I said Edward Snowden. And then this was the most bizarre thing. I said, who is Edward Snowden? And I just said, matter-of-factly, he is a whistleblower and an asylee. They next asked, who is Bradley Manning? And I said, a whistleblower. And then they asked, where is Bradley Manning? And I said, in jail. And he said, so he's a criminal. And I said that he's a political prisoner. And then they said, but you represent Snowden. And I said, yes, I'm a human rights attorney. And I'm one of his legal advisors. But I found that entire line of questioning very jarring and very unnerving. I didn't know what kind of answer I was supposed to give. I mean, obviously, it's like asking who is President Obama. They're asking about some of the most famous people on the planet. Obviously, I have an attorney-client relationship to protect. I'm not going to get into meetings that I've had with clients, and only some of my clients are public, Edward Snowden being one of them, so that's why I could answer that question. I walked away from the interview just shaking. During the interview, I was fine. I maintained my composure. But I walked away just shaking and just upset. I just cried. It was very intimidating and very, very, again, unnerving to be asked that line of questions as an attorney. And I don't think journalist or attorney should be harassed or intimidated at the border. And it's very disturbing to me that this has occurred in the U.S. and the U.K. And I've heard that this happened to someone recently in Germany, though I don't know the details of that. But certainly as an attorney, having gone to 14 different countries in the past year, I have never endured a line of questioning like that. You get the usual, hi, why are you here? Who are you seeing? Where are you staying? But not, who is Edward Snowden? Where is Edward Snowden? Where is Bradley Manning? Do you represent Bradley Manning? Which I wouldn't even be allowed to answer, obviously, because that would be attorney-client privileged information. I, in fact, do not represent him, but it would have put me in a really difficult situation of actually making a false statement if I did represent him and had to answer a question like that.
Justin, could you talk about the significance of the inhibited persons list? How did you first learn about it, and are you in fact on it?
As a graduate or an alumnus of the no-fly list, you're never officially told you are on this list. It's implied, and you hear it. This apparently is some list maintained in Great Britain, but originating from the Department of Homeland Security. And I wish I could tell you more about it, but that's just what I was able to learn from speaking with other people who've had difficulty getting out of the UK. My difficulty was getting in. I'm hoping I don't have any difficulty getting out. But an inhibited persons list, to me, is another kind of watch list, just like how ridiculous it was that I spent a number of years on the no-fly list when I obviously posed no direct threat to Snowden. I'm an attorney doing my job, and being a human rights lawyer does not pose any kind of immigration violation or safety threat to entering the United Kingdom. So I'm not sure why I was subjected to that interrogation other than to try to intimidate me from doing my job.
A new report based on leaks by Edward Snowden reveals the NSA played a role in the monitoring of a U.S. law firm that represented the Indonesian government during trade disputes with the United States. According to the New York Times, the NSA's Australian counterpart told the NSA it was spying on trade talks between the United States and Indonesia, including potentially privileged communications between Indonesian officials and the U.S. law firm Mayor Brown. The document notes the Australian agency has been able to continue to cover the talks, providing highly useful intelligence for interested U.S. customers. The report, front page New York Times by James Risen and Laura Poitras, bolsters claims by Snowden and others that the NSA and its allies conduct spying for economic gain. I wanted to bring Michael Ratner back into the conversation along with Jesselyn Radak. You're both attorneys. So this is spying on a U.S. law firm. Talk about the NSA and lawyers, which goes to everyone's legal rights.
I mean, I think there's two big points here. One you brought out, which is that this is economic spying. And Edward Snowden has said that what will be revealed as we go through these documents are more and more economic spying. And that essentially this whole claim that this is about stopping terrorism is just bogus, really. I mean, that's really what's going on. So I think that's a crucial point here. This was to get an advantage in various trade talks over shrimps, et cetera.
So it's just for the CIA, for the NSA, it's a new role after the Cold War. It's to be a spying arm for U.S. corporations?
That's what it appears to be, that they actually, not only for themselves in trade negotiations, but also may well feed this material to private corporations, U.S. corporations in particular. So I think that's one thing. The second thing, we've all been concerned for a very long time about spying on attorneys and our clients. And we do know that, for example, if I talk to my client, Julian Assange, that because he at least that we don't have any there's no public indictment of him. We don't know if he's actually been indicted. We suspect he is. But according to NSA spying rules, they can actually take in attorney-client conversations with our clients overseas as long as those clients haven't been indicted. That's just wide open. That's ridiculous. I mean, as an attorney, I have a right of legal confidentiality with my clients, indicted or not. So we know they're already doing that. In this case, of course, they were taking in a law firm suspected to be this law firm, Mayor Brown, which interestingly enough actually helped us with the Guantanamo cases. And they're taking in what they're negotiating or what advice they're giving to the Indonesian government. So it does seem to me at this point that certainly the lawyers' conversations with Julian Assange and all of our clients, Jesselyn's as well with her clients, are more likely that almost for sure just swept in there with no minimization, just all of our legal advice to our clients are taken in by the NSA. It's outrageous. I mean, the question I would have, what happened to Julian Assange's right to counsel? What happened to it? It's basically been destroyed by the NSA.
And Michael Ratner, why would they conduct this kind of surveillance now of lawyer-client correspondence? Only because they can?
Well, I think they want to know everything about what, for example, in the case of Julian Assange or other whistleblowers out there, or other publishers, what they're planning to do, what legal moves they might make. Like, for example, on these recent stories that have come out today, the Glenn Greenwald stories, are we planning to bring a lawsuit? What are we planning to do? If they can get what's going to be our legal take on it? If they can get advance notice of that, they can begin to counter it in their own publicity and how they deal with it legally, et cetera. There's a reason you have the attorney-client privilege, and that's so your client can share with you confidentially both what their situation is as well as what your legal tactics are. Essentially, the government now, it's wide open what the legal tactics are.
The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said in an interview published on Monday that the intelligence community should have told the American public about secret phone data collection when that program first began years ago. He told the Daily Beast, quote, "I probably shouldn't say this, but I will. Had we been transparent about this from the outset, right after 9/11, which is the genesis of the 215 program, and said both to the American people and to their elected representatives, we need to cover this gap. We need to make sure this never happens to us again. So here is what we are going to set up. Here is how it's going to work and why we have to do it. And here are the safeguards. We wouldn't have had the problem we had." Let me get your response to that, Michael Ratner. And then I'd like to hear from Jocelyn Radak and ask you, Jocelyn, as an attorney representing Edward Snowden, if you have any confidential a way to communicate with him.
I don't see how he could say there wouldn't have been a dramatic negative response to broad scale government spying on all our phone calls. I mean, what happened is it came out without the government saying it. And there was a huge response. I mean, it changed the perceptions in this country about what the NSA is doing. I don't think it would have made any difference had they put that forward in a different way. In fact, the one case where they finally admitted it, with which the warrant was wiretapping, there was a huge outcry about that. So I think this is fictitious. They shouldn't be doing it. They shouldn't be surveilling Americans' phone calls. They should get probable cause, and that's the only way, in my view, that you can actually do surveillance.
Jocelyn Radak.
I found what Clapper said completely disingenuous. We know that he perjured himself before Congress under oath on camera with no consequence. And this, again, strikes me as one of the least untruthful of his statements. So I take that with a grain of salt. He thinks it should be known because they got caught. And that is the only reason he continues to make these opportunistic statements. In terms of monitoring, I assume I'm being monitored. I am encrypted to the hilt. I'm not going to say what encryption techniques I use, but it's a really unfortunate way to do business as a lawyer to have to pretty much arrange meetings in person with your client and to have to be so encrypted and get into a very encrypted environment anytime you want to communicate. And in terms of spying on attorney-client relationships, you have to remember NSA is collecting bulk metadata. They don't have some carve-out for attorneys and clients. They don't have a carve-out for doctor-patient communications. They don't have a carve-out for communications between accountants and their clients. They have access to any of that information should they choose not only to collect it, but to go ahead and look at it. And there have been other instances, not only economic, but spying on political enemies like the Muslim charity Al-Haramain. And that case was not allowed to proceed because of, I believe, state secrets privilege in that particular one, where the government accidentally sent them the transcripts of recorded attorney-client conversations. So, the fact that this has occurred and has occurred a number of times and is now being documented, really, it's incumbent upon attorneys to use encryption. I have a disclaimer that my organization, the Government Accountability Project, came up with a disclaimer on every email that this communication may be monitored and collected without consent in secret by the NSA. I think everybody should have that kind of statement after their email, because I think it would raise public awareness about how insidious and widespread this problem is.
We have to wrap up, but I did want to ask, if you hadn't answered those questions at the airport, do you think you would have been barred from entry or arrested like David Miranda was, detained?
I certainly feared that, yes. And I feared that if I gave the wrong answers or was slipped with them in any kind of way, if I gave them any kind of brief whatsoever, yes, that was actually my fear.
Today is a big anniversary, Michael Reiner. What is it?
Well, today's the fourth anniversary, the actual day today, of the release by WikiLeaks of Reykjavik 13, which was the first Cablegate document released, which is the one that was showing there was pressure on Iceland to try and concede to IMF, et cetera, demands when they were going through their difficult economic period. It's the first one of the Cablegate document. So it's that anniversary. And just to give us some lightness, it's my daughter Anna's birthday today. So that's a way to get that in.
Well, thank you, Michael Reiner, for being with us, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is the legal advisor to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And thank you, Jesslyn Radack, for joining us, former ethics advisor to the Department of Justice under George W. Bush, currently Director of National Security and Human Rights at the Government Accountability Project. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Houston to speak with the New York Times reporter Stephen Greenhouse about a big labor defeat in Tennessee, the UAW defeat in a Volkswagen plant. Stay with us.
They call darkness.
It's coming along here. We're gonna find Abby Martin. I can just say that what Amy was talking about with her partner there, oh my God.
Washington, D.C. is one of the most expensive cities in America. If you look at all the business suits walking between K Street and Capitol Hill, you'd think that the city's practically recession-proof, which might have something to do with the high concentration of lobbyists and billions of lobby dollars that are peddled through the city every year. However, according to the watchdog website OpenSecrets.org, for the third year in a row, overall spending on lobbying has actually decreased to $3.2 billion, along with the official number of registered lobbyists to just over 12,000. Congressional lobbying experts, however, argue that lobbying isn't decreasing at all, and instead it's simply going underground. Well, earlier I spoke to investigative journalist for The Nation, Lee Fong, who just published an article called Where Have All the Lobbyists Gone? And he takes a closer look at what's been coined the shadow lobbying complex. I first asked him why the numbers posed on Open Secrets don't reveal the full story.
Well, the numbers that you are seeing on Open Secrets, which is a fantastic website, reflect the official lobbying registration system that's maintained by the House and Senate. The problem is the statute, the Lobbying Disclosure Act, is riddled with loopholes There are many ways for lobbyists to evade the law. And simply put, there aren't many incentives for lobbyists to register, and the law does not cover all lobbying activity. So the real figure on how many lobbyists are in D.C. that are actively attempting to influence policy is closer to 100,000, not 12,000. And experts say the amount spent is not $3 billion, but closer to maybe $6, $9, or even $10 billion.
Unbelievable. And you're talking about all these loopholes under the Lobbying Disclosure Act, named after former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. Why is he the face of unregistered lobbyists?
Well, Senator Tom Daschle left the Senate, joined a private equity firm, also joined a law and lobbying firm. Alston and Byrd is now at another one called DLA Piper. He's become the face of the problem because everyone knows that Tom Daschle lobbies, that he meets with government officials, that he meets with President Obama, that he coordinates meetings with legislators, with policy folks and businesses from healthcare and energy to other sectors. And he does this openly. And at the same time, he does not register. So given his prominence in Washington, D.C., you know, helping President Obama with his healthcare overhaul, associated with many different think tanks and constantly in the news and at different functions in the city, he does all of this while flouting the law.
You know, one of the most damning things about the article was Daschle's connection to the plan to have retailers like Gap skirt around responsibility for the Bangladesh garment factory collapse that killed more than 1,000 people. Lee, I was wondering if you could elaborate on that connection.
Sure. Well, we go through many different anecdotes, but this is one of the more tragic ones of how unregistered lobbyists peddle influence, and the public and the press is completely kept in the dark about who the real paymasters are. So, for this example, if you look in the last summer, in the aftermath of the latest major building collapse in Bangladesh, many European retailers offered a very strong plan to increase building inspections, to make sure that garment manufacturers or the retailers that pay the garment manufacturers are liable for these types of disasters. Well, American companies like Gap and Walmart and JCPenney did not like any of these reforms. They wanted to counter them. They didn't want to pay for any of these necessary upgrades or be liable for future disasters. So they had DLA Piper, Daschle's firm, go out and sell an alternative plan that does not keep them on the hook for any future liabilities, saving them a lot of money, but potentially causing more death and pain in the future. So what's interesting here is as DLA Piper lawyers and officials went around the city selling this alternative weak labor plan, no one knew that they were being paid by Gap, one of the big companies that refuse to play ball. That's just another example of this shadow lobbying complex, that you have folks selling policy, selling influence, and affecting the way these policies are enacted without registering and without disclosing. If you listen to their rhetoric when they were walking around the city selling this plan, they said that they're affiliated with think tanks or they're, you know, simply former government officials. No one knew who was really behind this plan simply because they didn't register.
Yeah, and you give seriously dozens of examples here. I mean, this is just one of them that goes layers and layers and layers as you're talking about right now. Lee, isn't there a way to investigate this? I mean, shouldn't the House Ethics Committee be overseeing the process of following up with those who are unregistered and still participating in lobbying?
That's a great question, and this was actually the most surprising part of reporting the story. I've covered lobbying and influence peddling for about 5 years now, and I did not know that the enforcement mechanism to the Lobbying Disclosure Act basically has no cop on the beat. There's never been a criminal enforcement case brought ever. There have been virtually no civil cases either, and that's because the only people overseeing this process of making sure people register and comply with the law There's only one full-time employee at the Department of Justice. That's a contract paralegal who basically just processes the forms. Some other kind of file keepers in Congress also look into this. But if you simply don't register and you continue influence peddling, there's no enforcement mechanism to go after folks.
That's insane. That's absolutely insane. So I guess we know the answer for all the lobbyists. Just don't register. You know, Lee, another thing in the article that you point out is the rebranding efforts on behalf of the lobbying industry. Can you give some examples of these and how renaming these institutions have changed their perceived role?
Right. I think if you look at public polling, Americans are incredibly upset about the role of big money in politics, the way lobbyists have taken control of the political process, have really taken control of both political parties. And to kind of combat this growing cynicism, whether from Occupy or the Tea Party, rather than changing their behavior or complying better with the law, lobbyists are instead simply changing their image, changing the names of their titles. So, for example, the American League of Lobbyists, a professional association for lobbyists, in November changed their name to Government Affairs Associates, or Government Affairs Professionals. So that's a much more vanilla name. They take the L word out of it. They don't want to be called lobbyists. They call themselves other euphemisms like Public Affairs Associates, or government affairs, government relations, that type of thing.
You know, I wanted to point to just one think tank here in D.C., the Employment Policies Institute. Sounds very innocuous, a widely quoted economic research center pushing the notion that increasing the minimum wage would increase poverty. But it's backed by the National Restaurant Association. Lee, do you think the polarization of issues in this country can be blamed on ideological front groups backed by massive lobbying efforts?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. A lot of the political debates we see on television, in the media, are not much more than political theater propped up by characters who are saying what they're saying or pushing a certain policy because someone's paying them and you don't know who they are. They'll say, oh, this is to help the Democrats or to help the Republicans. But in many cases, they're pushing a very narrow corporate interest without revealing who their true paymasters are.
How much of legislation would you say is written by lobbyists? I remember doing an investigation into just California state legislature, and it was like, I think 60%. This was a couple of years ago. I was just wondering if you had any insight on the federal level here.
Well, you know, California, you know, for all of its flaws, and as you know, I'm a recent transplant to the state. It's very corrupt, but at least you have a system of showing who sponsors bills.
Exactly.
In Sacramento. In Washington, and I just finished a reporting trip in Idaho, and the lobbyists actually wear name IDs. So there's a lot of problems in Idaho, but there's certain elements of transparency. In Congress, there are no such standards. Lobbyists write bills every day. They're sponsoring legislation, but there's no system to keep tabs on that.
Lee, you know, you mentioned before, of course, Open Secrets, an excellent website. Even they aren't tracking the dark money. It takes something like you, a very in-depth investigation. How do we follow this? I mean, what do we do to follow this trend here?
That's a good question. Well, I just relaunched my this is a self-plug. last week I relaunched my investigative blog, republicreport.org, and there are many reporters who are following the money trail, trying to uncover these types of stories. But I have to say, it's very difficult because so much of the system has been pushed into the darkness. It's purposefully secret. And in some cases, you know, for this story that I reported yesterday, you only stumble into it. You know, the opening anecdote to that story, finding a former congressman lobbying for Palantir, I just overheard him bragging about it on Capitol Hill. You just stumble into it sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I love about it. You were very natural. You were there on Capitol Hill trying to figure out what was going on, and you saw firsthand kind of the shady wheelings and dealings of all these people. You know, I was speaking to Jack Abramoff the other day, and he said that Citizens United didn't actually make it easier for lobbyists because they'll always find a way to get around it. What do you think, Lee? Do you think Citizens United exacerbated this problem?
Well, I'm of two minds on Citizens United and lobbyists. For one thing, it makes raising money for a politician easier. Instead of having to be on the phones for sometimes 8 hours a day for some of these politicians, begging people for these $3,000, $5,000 checks, you can just find one a sponsor, someone who bring in a super PAC that can dump $1 million into your district, that makes it much easier. So it's kind of counterintuitive thing. At the same time, it makes corruption much worse, because if a chemical industry lobbyist wants to pressure a senator or a congressman, all they have to do now is set up a front group and funnel corporate money into that front group, unlimited amounts of money, and it's very easy to pressure a lawmaker when the corruption is that simple.
Right, and the Koch brothers, of course, have mastered this. How do we stop this toxic cycle, Lee? Because, of course, in order to play the game, you got to have a lobby on the Hill now.
No, that's right. And, I've talked to a lot of campaign finance experts, folks who are interested in good government, and there's a consensus that we need better laws. And I don't disagree with that necessarily, but we also need enforcement. So there's no political will at the Department of Justice, and there's no resources devoted into investigating federal corruption. I think citizens need to demand that type of enforcement, because there are laws on the books. They simply aren't being enforced.
Thank you so much. Excellent work. Lee Fong, journalist, contributor at The Nation. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Abby.
That's our show, you guys. Thanks for watching. Join me again next week when I break the set all over again. Thank all the people from all over the world who are sending in pictures and videos, letting us know what you think. Again, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And I'm also thinking today about Julie Drizin, who is the first producer of Democracy Now, and also our colleague Sharif Abdelkaddous, who is in Cairo in Egypt, and our colleagues Anjali Kamat and Nicole Salazar and so many others who help make this program great, as well as Chris Abrams out there in Colorado. Well, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We've been with you for 18 years as we turn to another story.
Yes. Now we turn to the story of a University of California scientist who discovered that a popular herbicide may have harmful effects on the endocrine system. Tyrone Hayes was first hired in 1997 by a company that later became agribusiness giant Syngenta. They asked him to study their product, atrazine, a pesticide that is applied to more than half the corn crops in the United States and widely used on golf courses and Christmas tree farms. But after Hayes found results that the manufacturer did not expect, that atrazine causes sexual abnormalities in frogs and could cause the same problems for humans, Syngenta refused to allow him to publish his work. This was the start of an epic feud between the scientist and the corporation.
Now a new article in the New Yorker magazine uses court documents from a class action lawsuit against Syngenta to show how it sought to prevent the Environmental Protection Agency from banning the profitable chemical, which is already banned by the European Union. To start with, the company's public relations team drafted a list of four goals. Reporter Rachel Aviv writes, quote, the first was, quote, discredit Hayes. In a spiral-bound notebook, Syngenta's communications manager, Sherry Ford, who referred to Hayes by his initials, wrote that the company could prevent citing of data by revealing him as non-credible. He was a frequent topic of conversation at company meetings. Syngenta looked for ways to exploit Hayes' false problems. If TH involved in scandal, Enviros will drop him, Ford wrote. Well, for more, we're joined by TH himself. That's right. Tyrone Hayes is with us, professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley, joining us from the campus TV station right now in Berkeley. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us what happened to you, how you were originally tied to Syngenta, the research you did, and what prevented you from originally publishing it?
Well, here at Berkeley, I was a new assistant professor. I was already studying the effects of hormones and the effects of chemicals that interfere with hormones on amphibian development. And I was approached by the manufacturer and asked to study the effects of atrazine, the herbicide, on frogs. And after I discovered that it interfered with male development and caused males to turn into females to develop eggs, the company tried to prevent me from publishing and from discussing that work with other scientists outside of their panel.
What was the process within the company as you raised your findings? What was their immediate reaction to what you had come across?
Well, initially they seemed sort of supportive. We designed more studies, we designed more analysis, and they encouraged me to do more analysis. But as the further analysis just supported the original finding, they became less interested in moving forward very quickly. And eventually they moved to asking me to manipulate data or to misrepresent data. And ultimately they told me I could not publish or could not talk about the data outside of their closed panel.
And Professor Hayes, talk about exactly what you found. What were the abnormalities you found in frogs, the gender-bending nature of this drug, mm-hmm. atrazine?
Well, initially we found that the larynx or the voice box in exposed males didn't grow properly. And this was an indication that the male hormone testosterone was not being produced at appropriate levels. And eventually we found that not only were these males demasculinized or chemically castrated, but they also were starting to develop ovaries or starting to develop eggs. And eventually we discovered that these males didn't breed properly, that some of the males actually completely turned into females. So we had genetic males that were laying eggs and reproducing as females. And now we're starting to show that some of these males actually show, what we call homosexual behavior. They actually prefer to mate with other males.
And so where did you go with your research?
Well, eventually what happened was the EPA insisted that the Environmental Protection Agency insisted that the manufacturer release me from the confidentiality contract. And we published our findings in pretty high ranking journals such as Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. We published some work in Nature. We published work in Environmental Health Perspectives, which is a journal sponsored by the National Institutes of Health.
And when did you begin to get a sense that the company was organizing a campaign against you? What were the signs that you saw post the period when you published your findings?
Before we published the findings and before the EPA became involved, the company tried to purchase the data. They tried to give me a new contract so that they would then control the data and the experiments. They actually tried to get me to come and visit the company to get control of those data. And when I refused, I invited them to the university. I offered to share data, but they wanted to purchase the data. And then they actually, as mentioned in a New York article, they actually hired scientists to try to refute the data or to pick apart the data. And eventually, they hired scientists to do experiments that they claim refuted our data, and then that escalated to the company, actually Tim Pasteur in particular, and others from the company coming to presentations that or lectures that I was giving to make handouts or to stand up and refute the data, and eventually it even led to things like threats of violence. Tim Pasteur, for example, before I would give a talk, would literally threaten, whisper in my ear that he could have me lynched, or he would quote said he would send some of his good old boys to show me what it's like to be gay. Or at one point he threatened my wife and my daughter with sexual violence. He would whisper things like, "Your wife's at home alone right now. How do you know I haven't sent somebody there to take care of her? Isn't your daughter there?" So eventually it really slipped into some, pretty scary tactics.
So what did you do? I mean, you're actually, I mean, this is very serious. You could bring criminal charges if you're being threatened and stalked in this way.
Well, initially, I went to my vice chancellor here at the university. I went to my dean. I went to legal counsel here at the university. And I was told by legal counsel that – well, I was told, first of all, by the vice chancellor for research at the time that, well, you published the work. It's over. So I don't understand what the problem is. And I tried to impress upon her, Beth Burnside at the time, that, you know, that it wasn't over, that I was really being pursued by the manufacturer. And eventually, when I spoke with the lawyer here at the university, I was told that, well, I represent the university and I protect the university from liability. You're kind of on your own. And I remember I looked at him and I said, but the very university, from the Latin universitas, is a collection of scholars, of teachers and students. So who is this entity, the university that you represent, that doesn't include me? But clearly there's some entity that doesn't really include us, the professors and students, and doesn't really protect our academic freedom, I think, the way that it should.
I wanted to ask you about one of your critics, Elizabeth Whalen, president of the American Council on Science and Health. When the New York Times ran a critical story about the herbicide as part of its Toxic Water series in 2009, she referred to its reporting as, quote, all the news that's fit to scare. This is a clip of Whalen from an interview on MSNBC.
I very much disagree with the New York Times story, which is really raising concerns about a totally bogus risk. Atrazine has been used for more than 50 years. It's very, very tightly regulated. Even the Environmental Protection Agency, which is not known for soft peddling about environmental chemicals, even they say it's safe.
Well, it turns out that Syngenta has been a long-term financial supporter of Whalen's organization, the American Council on Science and Health, paying them at least $100,000. Your comments on her remarks?
Well, again, they're paid remarks. And one of the most disheartening things in this whole process is that many of my critics, you know, it's one to be academic. If you come and say, well, we interpreted the data this way and we want to argue about this point, but these people really didn't even have an opinion. These opinions were written by the manufacturer and they were paid to put their names on them to endorse the opinions of the manufacturer. So, you know, that's one of the most disheartening things, is that they were really just personalities for sale. And many of the things that she's saying there is just not true. There, any independent study from any scientist that's not funded by Syngenta has found similar problems with atrazine, not just my work on frogs, but I've just published a paper with 22 scientists from around the world from 12 different countries who've shown that atrazine causes sexual problems in mammals, that atrazine causes sexual problems in birds, amphibians, fish. So it's not just my work in amphibians. And also with regards to the EPA, one of the scientific advisory panel members on the EPA that was supposed to review atrazine turns out is paid and works for Syngenta. So the whole process was tainted. And in fact, the EPA ignored the scientific advisory panel's opinion and actually decided to keep atrazine on the market and not to do any more studies when that clearly wasn't the recommendation of the scientific advisory panel.
I wanted to go back to a second to your remarks about your university, because obviously there are many questions about major universities around the country being in some way or other supported financially by the pharmaceutical or the drug industry. But you are at a prestigious university, one of the top universities in the country at Berkeley. Do you have some concerns about how your university responded to in your time of need and the attack on your academic integrity?
Well, they're not just my concerns. There are many at the university who fear that the university is just becoming a corporation. You know, we're a public university that used to get a lot more support from the state. In my lifetime, the tuition was free for students. Tuition's been rising, and it's really an effort to monetize things, and that includes scientific researchers. There's a lot of pressure on us not just to be scholars and to teach and to do research, but also to bring in funds that will support the university. So there's some sentiment from the university that if you are raising a concern potentially that it might cause the university to lose support or to lose funders, then you won't necessarily get the support on the campus that you need. And we've seen this over and over again. A colleague of mine, Ignacio Chapella, for example, was in a fairly huge battle over the same company, Novartis, and its influences over scientific research at the university.
Can you talk about the significance of Syngenta? First of all, is it a significant presence at the university at UC Berkeley? But also the significance of Syngenta as a pesticide company and all that it makes. How powerful is it?
Well, when I was originally consulting for the manufacturer, they were Novartis at the time, and Novartis had a big influence on the campus. There was a major deal on the campus. I understand a fifth of the biological sciences support was coming from Novartis, and at the time, they both made pesticides and they made pharmaceuticals. One of my big concerns is that as of the year 2000, prior to the year 2000, the Novartis not only made atrazine, which is used on corn, of course, which is an herbicide, but it also induces an enzyme called aromatase. It causes you to make too much estrogen. And it's now been shown that this herbicide atrazine and this mechanism is potentially involved in development of breast cancer, for example. Up until 2000, the company also made a chemical called letrozole, which did exactly the opposite. It blocked aromatase, it blocked this enzyme, it blocked estrogen production, and this chemical letrozole is the number one treatment for breast cancer. So this company was simultaneously in 2000 making a chemical that induced estrogen and promoted breast cancer, and making a chemical that blocked estrogen production and was being used to treat breast cancer. So there's a clear conflict of interest there, a clear problem. The other problems are that something like 90% of the seeds that we use to produce our food right now are owned by the big six pesticide companies. So again, there's a conflict of interest where the companies have an interest in getting us addicted to the pesticides to grow the seeds that they also own. And Syngenta, of course, is one of those big six, one of the big pesticide or agribusiness companies.
And a New Yorker article that delves into your story also says that you came to find out that the company was also reading your emails. Could you talk about that?
Well, I had some suspicion that they had hacked into my email, and I originally found out there was a professor at Minnesota, and I was going there to give a big lecture, and this professor in the School of Public Health, Deb Dubinowski, said that she happened to be standing in line at the airport flying back to Minnesota, and just by coincidence, she was standing behind somebody who was having a conversation on his cell phone and who identified himself as an employee of Syngenta, and he made the statement, "We have access to his email. We know where he is at all times." So it wasn't just paranoia on my part. I had direct evidence that they had access to my email. And at the time, I maintained a second and a third email that I could keep private. And I actually used that information that they had access to my email to send them information and sometimes false information. For example, booking plane tickets through that email, because then I could send them to the wrong place so they wouldn't necessarily be there to follow me when I was going to speak in other places.
I mean, Professor Hayes, this is stunning stuff that came out in this class action suit. The suit wasn't brought by you, but the documents that came out that referenced you, Tyrone Hayes, TH, and trying to discredit you, trying to discredit your family. Talk about that was a lawsuit that involved atrazine contaminating water supplies. But what was your reaction when you saw this? You suspected this. You felt you were being followed. You felt they were trying to discredit you. But now you have the documents.
Well, it's funny. The way the article reads that, I suspected. I mean, I knew Tim Pester. I knew Sherry Ford. I knew many of the individuals who were following me around. I knew who they were. I knew they had access to my email. So for me, I knew that these things were happening. This guy would directly come up and make lewd comments to me and threatening comments to me. But it was the kind of thing where, it sounded like something out of a movie. I couldn't go and tell my colleagues, like, they're following me around and, they're hacking into my email.
Put on a tape recorder?
What I found, here's how I'll answer that question. What I found out that it was much more powerful for me to suggest and have them think that I recorded everything than for them to actually know what I recorded. And that actually became sort of my protection. So when this guy came up and threatened me and threatened my wife, to then go back and go, "Oh my God, did he record that or not?" So it was much more powerful for me to have them think that. But you can see in their handwritten notes that they were very concerned that I was recording conversations. There's notes that they wanted to trap me, to entice me to sue, and these kinds of things. And my reaction now to see it all in the New Yorker and for the, you know, all this open for the world to see is, but there are two reactions. One is I can't believe they wrote these kinds of things down, right? That you're plotting to you know, investigate me and investigate my school and investigate my hometown and all these kinds of things, and you wrote it down. But my other response is this is quite analogous to, you know, when you hear these stories of somebody who's been in jail for murder for 10 years and then the DNA evidence gets them out, you know, and you ask them, are you happy? Well, of course I'm happy. But I've also been in jail for 10 years, you know what I mean? So, of course, I'm happy now that these documents have all been revealed, but it's also been a very difficult time for me for the last – and for my family, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, for my students as well, for the last 10 or 15 years to be pursued this way and to be under a microscope this way and to be feel threatened this way for so long.
As we wrap up, what's happening with atrazine today? Where does it stand?
It's still on the market. We're still studying it. A number of studies are still coming out from around the world. One recent study has shown that male babies that are exposed in utero to atrazine, their genitals don't develop properly. Their penis doesn't develop properly, or they get microphallus. There's studies showing that sperm count goes down when you're exposed to atrazine. And this is not just laboratory animals or animals in the wild. This is also humans. We use the same hormones that animals do for our reproduction, and it's a big threat to environmental health and public health.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tyrone Hayes, a professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley, has devoted the past 15 years to studying atrazine, a widely used herbicide made by Syngenta. We'll link to the article in the New Yorker magazine that reveals how the company tried to discredit Professor Hayes after his research showed atrazine causes sexual abnormalities in frogs and could cause the same problems for humans. The article is called A Valuable Reputation, after Tyrone Hayes said that a chemical was harmful, its maker pursued him. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
In a beautiful world we live in, romantic place, beautiful people everywhere, the way they show they care, make me want to say, in a beautiful world, in a beautiful world, in a beautiful world, for you, for you.
People on Earth live in cities, and over the coming decades, that number will grow so much that by 2030, the World Health Organization estimates that 6 out of 10 people will live in urban areas. That's why right now, cities across the world are experimenting with new technologies to solve old problems like transportation and waste disposal. My guest for tonight's Conversations with the Great Minds, Anthony Townsend, the Senior Research Fellow at NYU's Rudin Center for Transportation, and has written at length about this phenomenon, as well as its potential dangers, in his new book, Smart Cities, Big Data, Civic Hackers, and the Quest for a New Utopia. Anthony joins us from our New York studios. Anthony, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I'd like to start with you. What gets somebody so interested and animated about urban planning issues that they dig in and write a brilliant book like this?
Well, I was a recently graduated student from Rutgers University back in 1994, and I had my degree in urban studies, but my first job out of college actually was in the telecommunications industry. I worked at AT&T in South Plainfield, New Jersey, at the headquarters of their just-launched internet service called WorldNet, and I got to see the internet basically spinning up firsthand. And sometimes I would work the overnight tech support shift, and a friend of mine down the hall would bring me into the control room, and they had this big map, almost like the map from the movie War Games, or, you know, what you might imagine, a NASA mission control kind of scene, big screen showing the AT&T national network. And he would type in a few commands and reroute traffic from one city to another. And I was just fascinated by that. I was fascinated by cities. And the idea that technology was going to become almost the new railroads, you know, fiber optic lines connecting cities, was something that I really wanted to learn about. And I basically spent the next 20 years studying.
Yeah, and you've certainly done well.
your book is both optimistic and cautionary. And I'd like to explore both of those threads. First of all, the optimistic part. You talk about the era of new smart cities. There are some that for example, the Plan It Valley in Portugal, the Kanza Techno City in Kenya, the Sungo in South Korea. There's some actual people are actually creating, or at least trying to create, really genuinely smart cities, low carbon footprint, all these kind of. Tell me about those. What is a smart city?
Well, you know, a smart city at the most basic level is a city where new digital technologies are being used to address these timeless urban problems like traffic, crime, waste disposal. In urban planning, the term smart often gets bandied about to describe a whole bunch of progressive policies like bike lanes or growth controls. But I really wanted to focus in on the role of technology, because I don't think technology is a silver bullet. And some of these digital utopias that you mentioned, like Songdo in Korea or Masdar in Abu Dhabi, really do try to use technology as a silver bullet that's going to solve all of our problems. And it's almost this false utopia that we can just simply install a piece of software and all these problems are going to go away. The real world is much more complicated than that. And the truth is that even the biggest of those showcase projects will never be home to more than 100,000 people. At the same time, we're talking about a million people a week either being born in or migrating to cities around the world. And so the scale of the problem is far beyond what these showcase projects are trying to accomplish.
So where do we begin? How do we, you know, we have cities. How do we make them smarter? Where do we begin?
Well, so what I really tried to do in the book was to debunk a lot of the hype that the idea of using information technology to tackle the problems of cities is a new thing. We've been doing this since the 10,000 years ago, the first day a nomad sat down and decided to plant a farm. And then markets and government and religious sites grew up around that. Writing was the first information technology, and it arose at the same time as the first human settlements. If you look at our own industrialization and urban growth in the U.S. and Europe in the late 19th century, you had technologies like the telegraph and the telephone, punch card machines that could tabulate data very quickly. Those technologies were invented precisely to govern massive growing cities of unprecedented size. And that's really what we're doing again now. But I think where we need to start is with problems and not with solutions. And, you know, we're about 5 or 6 years into this smart cities movement. It really started in 2008, which was the year that the world became 50% urban for the first time. It was also the year that there were more mobile broadband lines worldwide than fixed for the first time. So the internet became untethered for the first time. And it was also the year there were more things connected to the internet than people. And we're really starting to understand now that it's not that technology is going to drive the solutions. It's that we're going to identify the problems that technology can address.
And what are some of the most pressing problems that we can address with technology, and how do we do that?
Well, we've certainly seen urban security as an area where there is a lot of interest in applying technology. Sometimes it's overdone, as we've seen, you know, this year with all these revelations about kind of over surveillance. But security is a real issue in cities. We've seen a lot of interesting applications of technology around resilience and trying to make cities more able to withstand the shocks of both man-made or natural disasters. And energy and carbon emissions is the other one. You know, most of the infrastructure that we've inherited from the 20th century is tremendously inefficient and wasteful. And by putting sensors and remote controls into these networks, we can manage them in much more efficient ways that allow us to both save energy as well as eliminate the need to build additional roads or additional power plants.
I've read that if you live and work in London, that apparently that's the most observed city in the world, that you are photographed or identified 30 some odd times in an average day. Is something that would give George Orwell, you know, he'd be running out of the room screaming. How do we know, first of all, has that measurably improved the security of London? And secondly, how do we know where to draw lines, just to start with that security issue? between, you know, privacy and appropriate security.
I mean, if you could prove to me that walking around a city like London or New York or Washington, I'm only photographed 30 times a day, I'd treat that as good news in today's environment. I suspect it's actually 10 or 100 times more than that. And it's not just government that's doing the photographing. Retailers now are using all kinds of sensing technologies to understand who's in their stores, what are they looking at. Are they responding to advertising in the environment? People are surveilling each other. We have very high resolution cameras in our pockets that we use quite often. We saw, for instance, after the Boston Marathon bombing that there's actually really valuable information that is captured on those cameras that people are carrying around, in their pockets. I think it's really up to any society to decide where it draws the line. I just spent a week in Singapore, which is a country that has a very different view about the government's role in monitoring citizens' activities. Citizens have a very different view than we do of what the government should be allowed to do and what the trade-offs between invasion of privacy and public good are. And I think it's something that we're going to see play out in very different ways around the world. And it's almost impossible to predict how it plays out. There was a news article about 6 months ago about a company in London, actually, that was tracking people as they moved around the financial district using the stray wireless signals that come off of your cell phone when it talks to the tower. And there was an uproar about it, and the city government came in and basically shut the company down. And then, a few months later, there was a cover story in the Wall Street Journal about a company that's doing the exact same thing in Toronto, and nobody bats an eyelash. Two very similar societies with a shared culture, shared legal system, even reacting totally differently to the same technological intervention. And I find that it shows just how complicated these issues are and how difficult it is to anticipate how people react to them.
I was really surprised when Google got outed when they were doing their Street View stuff, and it turned out that they were finding people's open Wi-Fi networks, and in some cases even password protected ones, and basically going in and sucking down information from your home computer as they drove by, and that it didn't produce congressional hearings, that there wasn't, shock. I mean, are we at a greater risk of loss of privacy from the private sector than the public sector? Now, compare that to contrast that to Ed Snowden's revelations about the NSA.
Absolutely. I mean, the amount of data that the governments are collecting is just stupendous. I came across a figure today. Some of my colleagues at NYU have estimated that New York City's government collects a terabyte of data each day about what's happening in the city and what citizens are doing.
It's a
lot of hard drives worth. And that's a fraction of what the private sector collects on a daily basis, just in this city. I think this era of big data is really, we're in a very risky period right now where the companies that are deploying these sensory mechanisms are, they're so enamored of the capabilities that they've created that, the urge is to collect first, archive, and then, figure out what to do with it later. And so it's almost like a land rush that's going on to deploy sensor networks to collect the data, and then to basically, unleash as much computing power as possible on it to create value out of it.
So we have corporations trying to monetize our privacy. We have cities trying to use this for security. How does this fit in with smart cities? How can cities use that information in a way that really is consistent with urban planning goals?
It's really basically at the bottom line about managing government as effectively and as objectively as many businesses manage their own operations. So, the idea of introducing performance indicators or quantitative measures of how government is doing is something that's actually quite new. The other big area that people are really excited about is being able not just to react to problems that happen in a city, but to predict. So predicting when a wheel on a subway car may fail based on all of your observations of how those wheels have failed in the past. Looking at different data sets, say Meals on Wheels delivery, tax delinquencies, and mashing that up and being able to identify senior citizens that might be at risk during a heat emergency or a blizzard. These are the kinds of things that I think get people in government very excited, because it's not just about being more efficient or more transparent. It's actually about transforming the way government works and innovating the way government delivers services. And frankly, citizens have come to expect the same level of innovation from government that they experience in the marketplace when they buy goods and services. And it's really been a very difficult thing for local governments, especially who are cash strapped all over the world right now, and particularly in the U.S., to keep up with those expectations.
More of tonight's conversations with great minds with Anthony Towns right after the break.
Muting canceled.
Okay, so I called the radio and got me to listen to for a minute while Don checked out what happened to Tara and Rama. So I don't know if I have anything to share at all. The weather in North Carolina. Let's just keep the governor here. Oh, not so soon. But well, I'm glad that there's a federal investigation going on anyway. North Carolina, I'm very excited. That's my update from North Carolina.
Hello?
Hi, where'd you go?
I don't know. We didn't know we were gone. So
well, I called in, and Don told me to take to talk on the radio on your call while he went and checked you out.
Okay, well, we're back. So where did you miss us?
We missed you at the very end of that, and when they said we're going to take a break, and then they did.
Okay, we'll
that's
start
a long break.
We'll start the second section right now. Here we go, everybody.
Jones is a senior research fellow at NYU's Rubin Center for Transportation and author of the new book Smart Cities, Big Data, Civic Hackers, and the Quest for a New Utopia. Anthony, what is a civic hacker?
A civic hacker is someone who is using new digital technologies to try to reinvent government, essentially, or to try and reinvent their community. And a lot of them are working with open data, open government data, which is a trend that's really taken hold in cities and nations around the world since roughly 2008, 2009, when it began in Washington, D.C., actually, with then CTO of the city, Vivek Kundra, released a bunch of data sets that the city had previously had scattered all over the web or not released at all. And basically, they're trying to use this data to create services, to create maps, to create stories about what's happening in cities that allows people to make change and to experience their city in a more, you know, useful fashion.
Now, into this realm, this public civic realm, we find a lot of for-profit corporations stepping. Mm-hmm. You talked about IBM's operations center in Rio de Janeiro, and I don't want to characterize your characterization, but it seemed like you were less than satisfied with the way that Rio is portraying itself as a smart city. You want to riff on that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I wrote the book was, I'm trained as an urban planner. I know about cities. I educated myself over many years about technology and how technology was fitting into cities, particularly internet and network technologies. I really saw technology in the service of cities, not cities in the service of technology. In 2008, IBM really kind of opened the floodgates as the fiscal crisis, the financial crisis hit, and their corporate customers stopped buying their technology and services. They looked to governments, which were ramping up stimulus spending, and they launched a very, very aggressive marketing campaign that made some really bold and, I think, unfounded claims that they could fix all the problems of cities, essentially by just installing a piece of software. And there were other companies that came along, like Cisco Systems, that were promising, visions of cities based around their products in much the same fashion that General Motors sold us on a vision of, a landscape, a suburban landscape, organized around their products. And I felt compelled to respond to that because they were peddling a kind of cracker barrel understanding of how cities work and how government works. And I felt the need to set the record straight.
Back in the 19-teens, General Motors and I believe it was Firestone, it was one of the big tire companies, went to Los Angeles and said, we will take, and Los Angeles at that time had the best above ground and trolley system in the country, best public transportation system in the country, said, we'll run it for you, privatize it to us. And they did. And then the car company and the tire company ripped up all the tracks and LA has been suffering ever since. Are you suggesting that not necessarily IBM specifically, but that some of these companies that are hopping into this milieu and saying, hey, we can solve these problems, are doing essentially the same thing that General Motors and that tire company were convicted of fraud for in a trial in the 1920s, as I recall.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as clear cut, but I think we're at a very similar period to really kind of the post-war U.S. period when we basically made a decision that we were going to divest in our cities and invest in motorization, basically, and build a whole structure and a culture, essentially, around it. A lot of what we're trying to do now with smart technology and smart cities is to undo the consequences of motorization. And so the way I feel is rather than making a whole new set of mistakes on top of the ones we've already made, we really need to look long term and think about what could go wrong with the deployment of all these technologies and some of the things we've covered around privacy. I mean, there's still time to put that genie back in the bottle, I think, but we have to do it deliberately. We have to design our cities to not be surveillance chambers or panopticons. I think resilience is another big issue where we may be digging ourselves into a ditch with some of these technologies. If you look at things like Amazon Web Services, which powers thousands of apps and thousands of smart city solutions all around the world, it's really a handful of buildings, data centers, you know, that Amazon runs. If one of those goes offline, and that could seriously disrupt cities all over the world. And, you know, the example I like to use is you know, it's one thing if your Netflix goes out or an app stops working, but what if the fingerprint authentication system that you used to get in your front door goes down? What if it goes down for the whole neighborhood or the whole city? That could be a huge problem. The global positioning system, the GPS satellite network, OMB has gone out after the Air Force repeatedly for not maintaining the system at the level of reliability that it needs to be maintained at. And, you know, the UK government issued a report that was basically saying, you know, we need to stop depending upon the United States for this service because it's woven into our economy in so many ways that we don't even understand. So there's a lot of these single points of failure in smart cities that I think are something that we really have to assess the risks as we wade in and we build these things.
So if a city is looking at localizing, basically, if for example New York City were to say, okay, we're going to become more resilient, and we're going to do that in part by not using Silicon Valley data centers to run our city. We're going to do all that here. Is it better to do it at the level of the city itself or at the level of the neighborhood? Should they say, you know, okay, Soho is going to have its own center, and Greenwich Village will have its center, and Hell's Kitchen, you know, that's thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot of factors to consider, and you know, I think that the really difficult thing to navigate going forward with these systems is that at the end of the day, the objective of many of these systems is to make our cities as efficient as possible, so that we can operate them more cheaply, and you know, with less energy use and less emissions. But a lot of times, squeezing out the excess capacity actually makes you more vulnerable to a disruption or a crisis. And we see this in the cellular telephone network. I mean, the cellular telephone network is optimized for peak peacetime activity, not for peak crisis activity. And every time we have a disaster, you know, whether it's the Boston Marathon bombing or the Sandy flood here in New York City, we see the networks go down from overutilization. I think that the neighborhood versus city question is really interesting. And in the New York region, there's a lot of activity going on trying to think about how we beef the region's defenses up for another disaster. And I think the most progressive thinking is actually saying that we need to have almost autonomy at the neighborhood level across all of the critical infrastructure systems, water, food, energy, telecommunications, and I think that's something that we're going to start to see. Now, whether that means that a city government's kind of routine services are going to be distributed throughout the city, there's really powerful economic forces that say you kind of want to consolidate, centralize some of that stuff. So it's going to depend on what system we're talking about and how much how critical it is in the event of a disaster.
That's fascinating. I'd always thought of that in terms of economics or politics. I wrote an op-ed years ago called "Praise of Inefficiency." We've got six banks that control assets equal to 65% of the entire GDP of the United States. They're very efficient. They used to be over 700 banks. Now they're only six. The 700 got condensed into, but they're not very resilient. You know, in 2008, we had to bail them all off. So you're saying the same thing happens in the cities. What about the suburban versus urban? We've got these suburban areas that are not quite cities, but and they're highly dependent on vehicles. What do we do with that?
Well, I mean, this is the big question. You know, a lot of urban planners in the U.S. would like to reverse the trend towards suburbanization. There's a lot of demographic and economic factors that are actually starting to make suburbs less attractive for lots of different groups, for old people who need health care and can't drive themselves as they age, to young people who want a different kind of lifestyle. But I think a lot of these technologies are actually going to extend the viability of suburbs by making surface transportation more efficient, by helping manage traffic congestion. There was even a study that I saw that came out of a European research group that was arguing that suburban density is actually the best land use pattern for large-scale distributed solar production because you have the surface area on the rooftops that you need to actually produce the power. And so, you know, I think the suburbs aren't I wouldn't write the obituary on the suburbs yet. I think they have a lot of life left in them.
That makes perfect sense. Chattanooga, with their gig, Chattanooga has a broadband system that is owned by the people and operated for the people by the city, as opposed to having Comcast or Verizon do it. What's the result of that?
They have world-class broadband now. I spent some time in Korea in 2004. I was there for about 6 months. You know, Chattanooga is catching up with where Korea was in 2004. The rest of the United States is a decade behind that. I was in Singapore, as I mentioned last week, where the government has wired the entire country with gigabit speed broadband because, in their view, it was an excellent investment in the future. You know, we live in a country that's kind of unique among developed nations that doesn't see its telecommunications infrastructure as a key to its future, sees it as just another industry. That can regulate itself. And it's clear that it's failing.
Well, we think that way about all of our infrastructures. We think that way about our educational infrastructure, you know, with privatizing education, our intellectual infrastructure. We think that, but don't get me started. Crowdsourcing is all the rage right now. Can you talk about crowdsourcing in smart cities?
Well, you know, what's really interesting about a lot of the technologies that we've seen, come to the market in the last 10 years, is that they're essentially about coordinating human activity. In a lot of ways, that's what cities are about. Cities are platforms for coordinating human activity, whether it's commerce or culture or education. And so particularly in an era of, very severe fiscal strains at the local level, we've seen people come up with some very clever ways to use these technologies of cooperation to augment or even in some cases replace services the government used to provide. And the whole crowdfunding phenomenon, Kickstarter platforms like that allow people to, essentially pass a hat around to support an artist or a technology project. We're seeing that being applied to the civic space. So people are crowdfunding community gardens. They're crowdfunding other kinds of civic improvements. And I think it's a fantastic way of thinking about how we can build our cities together in a very participatory way.
I absolutely agree. Anthony Townsend, brilliant. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
To see this and other Conversations with Great Minds, go to our website at conversationswithgreatminds.com. And that's the way it is. Tonight, Friday, February 21st, 2014. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, there's a new game in town. It's called the Hunger Gains. Housing gains plus hunger pains equals the Hunger Gains. While a user on my website named Andy Perry coined the phrase, it was David Cameron who invented the brutal game in which there are no housing gains without hunger pains. Stacy.
Yes, Max, it's a brutal game. Welcome to this world where there are no wealth creation jobs or wealth creating industry. We have just the financialized world of a zero-sum game. So therefore, you can only have wealth redistribution, and it looks like it's been turned into a game of gains versus hunger pains. David Cameron rejects help to buy housing bubble fear. Prime Minister David Cameron has dismissed fears the help to buy scheme is creating a property market bubble as he hailed it as a success. Number 10 says almost 750 homes have been bought and 6,000 offers made since the mortgage guarantee scheme started. Now, this was in the beginning of January, and now, this week, we hear that the average house price has now passed £250,000 in the United Kingdom. That's over $400,000 US.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradox. If you were to tell the average British person, hey, guess what? The price of gas just doubled, or petrol, as they call it here. Price of petrol just doubled. Isn't that great? Of course, the average person would say, no, that's terrible. If you tell them, hey, the average house price just doubled. Isn't that great? Well, no, not really, because it causes an enormous economic strain that results in, as we're pointing out here, hunger pains. The number of people going hungry in the UK to afford for David Cameron's re-election buy-to-help scheme and housing bubble is human tragedy, of which he cares not.
Well, Shelter, which is the homeless charity here, has warned that prices are spiraling out of control and they're seeing a huge rise in homelessness because of not only the house price gains, but also the inflation.
Yes, the way that inflation is calculated does not include the daily necessities in the proportion that people consume them. If you were to do an accurate reading, you would end up with an 8 to 9% inflation with wages barely moving, which is leading to poverty.
So now Vince Cable has said there's a raging housing boom in London. And of course, house prices here in London are up over 12% in the past 12 months. But in general, over the UK, it's now £250,000. Average UK house price hits £250,000, ONS says. So this is the Office of the National Statistics, and they said that in 2013, house prices rose by 5.5%, though the nationwide says that it actually rose 8.4% across the UK, including London, which is over 12%.
Well, you know, it's like a super tanker filled with quantitative easing cash that's moving through this narrow channel called the British economy on the benefit of those who are living inside that super tanker, but everyone living on the banks is getting flooded out. And that flooding, by the way, in the UK recently is a direct result of money not being spent on infrastructure and going right into the pockets of financiers and housing speculators. So people are starving. They're being flooded out of their homes. For David Cameron's re-election help to buy Ponzi housing bubble, which is enabled by Mark Carney, who just left Canada after building an enormous housing bubble there that has just popped, that's now collapsing in the wake of his financial tragedy.
Of course, you look at that price, £250,000 across the UK, right, for the average house price. The average income here is something like £26,000. So you do the math or the math if you're British. Now let's turn to the hunger pain part of these games. David Cameron defends moral benefit cuts, says they bring hope. David Cameron has denied that benefit cuts are plunging people into poverty, saying they actually give people hope. The Prime Minister hit back at criticism from the head of the Roman Catholic Church in England and Wales, insisting that they were part of his moral mission for the country.
Well, David Cameron is a troll. And what I mean by that is there was some study done recently to examine the psychological profile of a troll, and they found that they are sadistic and cruel.
Yes.
And David Cameron is sadistic and cruel in his interpretation of economics, which suggests that by cutting people's benefits to make more money available for housing price speculation is somehow sound economic policy. That's beyond just making bad decisions. That's sadistic and cruel.
Yeah. Now, remember the first part where we're talking about the housing gains, he kept on rejecting. He rejected the notion that his plans, his policies of the help to buy were causing it. Here he's denying his policies are causing the hunger. And yet, public health emergency declared as 1 in 6 GPs was asked to refer a patient to food banks in the last year. 1 in 6 family doctors has been asked to refer a patient to a food bank in the past year, a new survey has found, with GPs reporting that benefits delays are leaving people without money for food for weeks on end. So 5,500 people were treated for malnutrition in hospitals in the UK last year, and over 500,000 people visited food banks. Now, the Church of England as well also came out. Several bishops, hundreds of bishops, actually dozens of them, came out, and they said that it was the delay. You speak of sadism. It was the delay. They keep on being given these delays in their benefits, receiving their benefits. There's all sorts of arbitrary delays. So people are suddenly losing access to food.
Yes. Mark Carney, the Bank of England chair, speaks of the UK economy achieving escape velocity. The idea being that if we keep the housing bubble pumped, at some point it will trickle down to the masses. Mm. This is the same theory that was used in America when the U.S. Army rolled across the plains and displaced the indigenous population, thinking that someday when the American economy grows, the American Indian, as they're called, would somehow find a benefit. That 200 years later has not happened. Here, Cameron is rolling across Britain, displacing millions of British people, leaving them, consigning them to a life of poverty and flooding with no insurance, house prices, an enormous bubble, because he thinks he's going to achieve escape velocity, according to his theory, which so far throughout history has never, ever happened. You've never been able to cure a debt problem by increasing more debt. What Cameron fails to mention, and this is part of his cruel, sadistic propaganda, is that the debt in Britain has never been higher. He's only increasing the debt. You know, I mean, it's the same theory that they have in North Korea now. I mean, if you just genuflect to the leader in egregiously inappropriate manner, you will save yourself from the gulag, maybe. But in the UK, unless you kowtow to David Cameron, you're going to be flooded and starved to death.
Well, it's also a game, as we've pointed out, as you pointed out in your opening monologue, is that it's the Hunger Games. It's a game. It's a command and control game. The guy controlling it is Mark Carney and George Osborne and the likes of those people. Now, we're also going to look at the fact that you can't even work your way out of this hunger situation. You can't. There's no way to get out of the game without picking up the tools that they provide for the game players in this game. So here's a tweet from Robert Peston, who is the BBC economics editor. UK productivity, especially output per hour, fell further behind most rich country competitors in 2012. So these are the new data coming out. And again, productivity down here. That means wealth creation is down here. That means if you're not playing this game, the Hunger Games, then you're getting hungrier and more homeless.
Right. They don't want to pay people. Okay. What he was talking about there is that the hours worked for an hour's pay is getting less money.
Well, you're creating less wealth with every hour you're working, because there's nothing to do but to sell a burger at McDonald's. And there's this misallocation of capital, as we talked about previously.
They don't want to pay anybody. In other words, exactly. They only want to pay these bonuses to bankers for speculating on the housing bubble and creating financial mayhem. They don't want to pay people to work. And now wages and labor are just not needed. As we've explained before, the tax revenue needed to service the debt is not needed from collecting taxes from the average British citizen, because they just go to the Bank of England and they print the money to pay their schemes. They don't need labor. They're expendable. They don't need the citizens to work. They don't need their taxes. They don't need them. So they treat them like garbage. And Cameron just in the face of the British citizen, because he doesn't need them. He just needs them to come around every once in a while and vote. And of course, to get the vote, they don't care if they stage some kind of horrific catastrophe in some foreign land, create a catastrophe and get a vote for a month or two, and then go right back on the massive golden shower that is David Cameron's policies. He doesn't need the British citizen, so he treats them like dirt.
So the zero-sum game of the Hunger Games relies on, because it's not relying on wealth creation here in the UK or productivity gains here in the UK, just a reshuffling of wealth around the, you know, the city center. It relies on China to actually make stuff and create stuff, whether it's horse meat burgers or whatever. So China tapering U.S. debt faster than Fed, and this is regarding a Bloomberg article noting that China pared its position in U.S. government bonds by $47.8 billion, or 3.6%, to $1.27 trillion, the largest decline since December 2011, according to U.S. Treasury data. At the same time, international investors increased holdings by 1.4%, or by $78 billion in December, pushing foreign holdings to a record $5.79 trillion. So overseas investors hold 48.8% of the $11.9 trillion in tradable U.S. securities. China, and they're paring back radically.
Yeah, and who's picking up the slack? Is the American government itself is buying back its own debt. It's like a dog returning to eat its own vomit. I mean, that's the American financial policy. Same thing with Mark Carney. He should put on a doggy suit, and or maybe Doge, and go down there to the well of quantitative easing and just eat his own financial vomit, because that's the only policy they have here in the UK. And it'll only get worse, because foreign creditors don't want this junk debt that they're pushing, because it won't possibly pay off. There's no way that Britain will pay off its sovereign debt. And there's no scenario where that's going to happen. They will have to default, or they'll have to just keep printing until hyperinflation kicks in. In the meantime, a few people will get rich by speculating in the housing bubble. And this is a dead certainty, essentially. Stacey, we must go.
Okay.
Stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Alistair McLeod of GoldMoney.com. Alistair, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
It's my pleasure, Max.
All right, you wrote something fascinating here. Quote, the redemption of emerging market currencies into the U.S. dollar mirrors pre-World War I bank runs, except on a global scale. Talk about it.
Right. To understand the point, you have to bear in mind that before the First World War, we were on a gold standard. The world was on a gold standard. And you could exchange your dollars for gold. You could exchange your pound notes for sovereigns. So the amount of paper that was built up in the global economy was essentially exchangeable into gold. Now, that failed because the weight of paper grew too large. We now have a situation where, cut the gold, we've now got the dollar. That is the reserve currency. So, in effect, all the currency in all the world is pyramided, if there is such a word, on top of the dollar. So we have a situation which is essentially unstable in the event that there is a run out of other currencies back into the dollar, or out of the dollar into other currencies, which would be a second order, as it were.
So the dollar is world reserve currency, and it is the base of a pyramid, so to speak, where all other currencies are basically collateralized by the U.S. dollar. So you're making the comparison pre-World War I, where all the global currencies were backed essentially by gold. You had a gold standard. The gold was the medium of exchange on a global basis. And that broke down, and it led to World War I. Is that a fairly common accepted wisdom by historians that World War I, because a lot of people talk about World War I and they say it was, the Archduke of Ferdinand got assassinated and it was an accident.
It's in the news now. It's the 100th anniversary.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, but can we look back and say this gold relationship and the breakdown, as you describe it, was really more, I think, part and parcel of why these events?
Yeah, I think World War I actually started for different reasons. You have the character of the Kaiser and his cousins, the Tsar and also our king.
Different spelling, by the way, than Max Kaiser.
Different spelling, indeed. The thing really sort of got out of control, and it looked like World War I. I mean, it's still controversial today how it started. So that was an accident, and I don't think it directly had anything to do with gold. The difference between the gold standard and the dollar as a reserve currency is that the gold standard worked on a fixed price. You could exchange your pounds for a fixed amount of gold, your dollars for a fixed amount of gold. There is no fixed price at all between the minor currencies and the dollar.
Okay. So,
but nonetheless, we do have this pyramid, and the pyramid is absolutely massive. I mean, for example, if you take the combined money supply of the next 50 currencies other than the dollar, we're looking at a total, call it M3, if you like, global M3, of around about $67 trillion equivalent. On top of that, you've got shadow banking. The Financial Stability Board, which at the time was headed by Mark Carney and a committee set up by the Bank of International Settlements, calculated in 2011 that shadow banking worldwide was $67 trillion. Sorry, I'm talking trillion dollars. I think I said billion earlier. So you add that into it. Now, today, given the acceleration of shadow banking in China, we're probably looking at about $75 trillion. Now, if you add up all these bits and pieces, you've got US M3, you've got global M3, and then you've got shadow banking. The gearing is roughly 40 times the monetary base in the United States. But if you take it even further and you say, what was it relative to the monetary base before the Lehman crisis, you end up with about 130 to 140 times. This is some gearing, and it's potentially very unstable.
Okay, you mentioned a few things there. So we'll touch on World War I again briefly and then move on. But the point being that pre-World War I, you had currencies that were trading off gold, and price of gold was known and the value was accepted. The difference being here, you've got dollar as a world reserve currency. Everything's priced in the dollar, but that value of the dollar is highly subjective. There is no clear
cut. Subjective. There is no fixed exchange rate between these currencies and the dollar.
Starting in 1971, the world went on this global fiat currency experiment when the U.S. closed the gold window. So everything is massively in flux. Yeah. But we do know that the amount of gearing or leverage has increased almost exponentially.
Yes.
And you're saying now that it's higher than the pre-Lehman situation. Post-Lehman, let's talk about that for a second, because after Lehman collapsed, the idea was we'd have some reform, we'd have some attempt to rein in the speculating.
That may have been the intention.
Right.
We had no reform. We had no reining in of speculation. Sorry.
It's just gone. The quantitative analyst on Wall Street said that the problem was not massive debt. The problem was we got our calculations wrong. We're gonna redo our calculations, and we're gonna double, triple, quadruple debt. It's just a repeat of the same madness, correct?
Absolutely. The solution to the Lehman crisis was to issue as much currency as it took to rescue the banks and stabilize the financial system. That is the inheritance we have today, and that is why we have got a money bubble of the proportions I've just described. It has its roots, in effect, in the Lehman crisis.
And you see. But at this moment, though, you do see evidence of a bit of a bank run.
Well, the potential is there. When we had the second tapering announcements, you saw that there was a big wobble in the Indian rupee, the Turkish lira, the Argentinian, and so on and so forth. All these sort of minor currencies suddenly sort of caught a cold. It then sort of settled down. Now, the reason that these minor currencies catch a cold is because they are entirely dependent on the balance of reserves they have in dollars to defend the currency and the amount of money, cross-border investment, that has gone into those economies to puff them up really from the days of the Lehman crisis, or more specifically, could probably go back to the year 2000. So if that international footloose money decides that the returns are not there and suddenly it is a question of risk rather than profit, then that is going to start flowing in the opposite direction. We then have the scenario which will look very, very like the post-Credit Anstalt crisis in 1934. I think it was 33, 34. So you can see that these flows are very, very important. And the reason that I highlight this is that this is a time when the Fed has decided to try and slow down the creation of money by introducing tapering on a month-for-month basis. And at the same time, China, the authorities in China have become very, very spooked about what's happening to money and credit in their own economy, and they're trying to rein that in. And you can see that the initial effect of that has been in a sort of a developing crisis, potentially, in the shadow banking system, where all these coal mines and all the rest of it who finance themselves through off-balance sheet lending, where people bought shares in a trust, which was set up specifically to collateralize a loan for this coal company, that coal company. These are coming unstuck. And China now has the problem. Does she rescue these things and say, look, you know, we're not printing any more money. We're not allowing the expansion of bank credit anymore. If you made the wrong investment, it's down to you, mate. You know, do they say that or do they rescue it? And that's where we are now. And so we've got the two largest economies in the world who have got this problem, and they are threatening to put the whole of the international investment flow situation into reverse. And that is a big, big danger. Now, I don't think it's necessarily going to carry through, because at some stage, I would assume that the Chinese and the Americans, Fed, would back off and say our priorities have changed and the threat now is to the economy from the global economy. They will come up with something else. But the way it looks at the moment, it is actually a very dangerous situation with all that monetary gearing. And that is the point I was trying to make.
Now, 2008, the Lehman crisis, the Fed printed unprecedented amounts of money, quantitative easing, et cetera. And then we find out later that most of it went to foreign banks. They went to Deutsche Bank. It went to BNP. It went to Societe Generale. And some Americans were outraged that, you know, this money didn't go to U.S. People. It went to foreign banks. So the way I envision this, if you will, is there's this enormous yo-yo, and the Fed kind of does a yo-yo trick, you know, where they spin that yo-yo out, and then it pops back into your hand. Mm-hmm. It seems like they put that money out there. They covered their counterparty risks for their own banks. And now that that's covered to some degree, they're snapping that money back, this tapering, and they're leaving these banks to fend for themselves. They're kind of leaving them in the cold. In the case now of Latin America banks, Central America banks, Venezuela, Argentina, these countries are now in flames.
Yes.
So how much responsibility does the Fed take or should take or might take or, in your opinion, should take for in getting these countries burning as they are with riots by this yo-yo approach of money?
Yeah. Well, if I had anything to do with it, we wouldn't have gone into the situation in the first place. The problem I think the Fed faces is that having embarked on the post-Lehman strategy of we will rescue the system, whatever happens, we will rescue it. We will produce enough money to do it. They're now seeing the downside of that, because if they're going to restrict the production of money, as you quite rightly point out, a lot of that is keeping the Eurozone afloat, for example.
Jump in for a second, because, of course, the U.S. is not happy with geopolitical trends in Latin America, Venezuela under Chavez, et cetera. By pulling in this money, turning off the spigot, they have a benefit in that these countries are now up for political grab. And the U.S., I'm sure, would not mind if they had to step in, as they've done before, and take control. I mean, this is what the history of this region has been. But let's just look on more on a global basis here, because as you point out, the key counterparty in all this is really China, and because China's really vying with the U.S. for economic global supremacy at this point. And as you describe it, the money's being pulled back. China's shadow banking system has been revealed. They're scrambling to cover what looks like a huge gap in their books.
By any description. Yeah.
So, but we also know that at the same time, China has been very aggressively accumulating gold. So the question is, did they see this coming? That's why they've been buying gold. And now that it's here, their worst nightmare, perhaps, do they have enough gold to cover their butts? So, you know, to put it in inelegant terms.
I would put it perhaps even more basically than that, and that is China is effectively the corner of the gold market. The amazing thing is that our statisticians in the West don't want to accept this.
So talk about this. What do you mean they've cornered the gold market? Talk about this.
Well, if you look at the amount of gold delivered into the public by the Shanghai Gold Exchange, that last year was around about 2,200 tons, not the 1,063 tons which the WGC managed to identify.
Their official reserve number.
No, I'm talking about into the public's hands. Into the public's hands. On top of that, gold was also retained by Hong Kong and their cross flows between the mainland and Hong Kong. And if you include Hong Kong, you're looking at a figure, including about 50 tons of coins, of around about 2,800 tons. Now, that is almost the same as world mine production. But there is a sting in the tail, because China is the largest producer of gold. And according to the China Gold Association, she produced 430 tons approximately in 2013. So you have to take that 430 tons out of the 2,800 ton figure, and you're left with around about 2,300 tons. So on the basis of Chinese public demand, the world is in a supply deficit and depending on scrap. So we've got this extraordinary situation, and none of the Western analysts in the sort of the mainstream banks and so on and so forth seem prepared to accept this. But it's there. I mean, these are the hardest statistics we have.
Okay, we've got about 10 seconds. So just in my question, though, do they have the gold needed to go into this financial currency war at this time? Are they well positioned for this currency war? Yes or no? We got about 5 seconds.
My suspicion is they knew what the situation was in the West, and they thought this was a very good strategic ploy.
Fair enough. Okay, Alistair, we got to go. Thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
That's my pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank my guest, Alistair MacLeod of goldmoney.com. If you'd like to contact us, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Oh, my, that was really interesting. And that goes with this one article that I didn't read, but It just says underneath the dead bodies of the banksters is the story. And this guy was nailing that story right here. So I didn't have to read the article. And did you see that he answered Tom Harton's question to the professor, Steve? We said, what was that again? What was that he was talking about? Oh, my brain. Oh, it came and it went, everybody. Tom Hartman was asking that question. And he answered it right in the, that's okay. Went out of my brain. But there is just after, you know, just paging through article upon article upon article, you can see how everything dovetails into everything else. And that's what he was talking about, where the foundation of this massive pyramid is the dollar. And again, every answer, every road now is coming to that Reformation Act, that it's irreparable system. So you just start over. Debt Jubilee, everybody. Debt Jubilee. Mr. Rolling Stone, too. He's got this big fat pig and on the front cover of this story. The vampire squid strikes again. The mega banks. Most devious scam yet. Banks are no longer just financing heavy industry. They are actually buying it all up and inventing bigger and bigger and scarier scams than ever. Remove the problemo, please.
I would just say they don't have enough gold on the planet to make a transaction with the folks from Nibiru because the planet's not for sale.
You tell that to the Pope. Thinks he owns it. Okay, chapter 30 in our lovely When Rocks Cry Out. Here we are, chapter 30. Know that Sonia asked us how many chapters there really are. We're not too far from the end. Sorry, everybody. I might be maybe, let's see. I think there's 10 more chapters like this. Yeah, it won't take long. Rama, you get a hold of Dahani. No more procrastination. Write that in your notebook. Okay, the Hyksos and their king called Saul. It's easy for me now to write that the Hebrews fled out of Egypt, then returned and took Egypt's city. However, as I first perceived that strange about faith, adrenaline rushed through me and stood me up, pulling my eyes from the reading. I had not anticipated that stunning return of events. In church, sermons that I had heard, the Hebrews had been quiet, mild-mannered, defenseless folks. Somehow the vicious battles at Adri and those near the Jabbok River never left an impression in my memory, or the sermons never touched those accounts. Hadn't the Hebrews simply walked around Jericho and the walls fell down? That walk at Jericho did not impress upon my young mind that the Hebrews were a merciless, slaughtering army of invaders, ruthless enough to frighten the hardened warriors of Egypt. I certainly did not notice that the Exodus included a Hebrew army, 100,000 soldiers strong, as some Old Testament passages quietly announced. Quote, "The Lord said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies." Exodus chapter 6, verse 26. Quote, "Yet Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt and bring forth mine armies out of the land of Egypt." Exodus chapter 7, verse 4. Quote, "And ye shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for in this selfsame day that I have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt." Exodus chapter 12, verse 17. "And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 on foot, that were men beside children." Exodus chapter 12, verse 37. It was hard to understand how I had not seen these armies, which were so clearly announced in the biblical writing. However, now I understood that these Hebrew armies invaded Egypt and took its cities. Egypt was the promised land. Duh. United States of America. That shocking piece of understanding answered many questions, including the vexing riddle, quote, "Who were the people called Hyksos who invaded and defeated Egypt during Old Testament times?" The Hyksos were indeed the Hebrews. Modern biblical scholars reasoned and argued that the Exodus took place during the time of Ramses II. Yet the autobiography of Moses, named Amenemhet I, names Amenemhet I as the Pharaoh who ruled when Moses fled to Paten. That revelation places Ramses about 700 years after the time of Moses and the Exodus. Oh my. As it is true that Pharaoh Amenemhet I died around 1970 BC, then the Exodus left the Yucatan Peninsula about 1940 BC. Historians, refusing to acknowledge Moses in the Egyptian records, had placed the Hebrews' flight from Egypt hundreds of years later than when it actually occurred. That error did not allow the Hebrews to be the invaders that Egyptian histories called Hyksos. Manetho, an Egyptian priest, told what Egyptian records said about the Hebrew invasion of Egypt. The Jewish historian Josephus put Manetho's record into his own history and quoted the Egyptian priest to say, quote, "There was a king of ours whose name was Timaus. Under him it came to pass, I know not how, that God was averse to us, and there came, after a surprising manner, men of ignoble birth out of the eastern parts, and had boldness enough to make an expedition into our country, and with ease subdued it by force." yet without our hazarding a battle with them. So, as they had gotten those that governed us under their power, they afterwards burnt down our cities and demolished the temples of the gods and used all the inhabitants after a most barbarous manner. Nay, some they slew and led their children and their wives into slavery. At length, they made one of themselves king, whose name was Salatis. S-A-L-A-T-I-S. He also lived at Memphis and made both the upper and lower regions pay tribute and left garrisons in places where that were the most proper for them. He chiefly aimed to secure the eastern part, as foreseeing that the Assyrians who had there the greatest power would be desirous of that kingdom and invade them. And as he found in the Saite or Sethroite Nomos, a city very proper for his purpose, and which lay upon the Bubastic channel, yet with regard to the certain theological notion, was called Avaris. This he rebuilt and made very strong by the walls he built about it, and by a most numerous garrison of 240,000 armed men, whom he put into it to keep it. Thither Salatis came in summertime, partly to gather his corn and pay his soldiers their wages, and partly to exercise his armed men, and thereby to terrify foreigners. As this man had reigned 13 years, after him reigned another, whose name was Baon, for 44 years. After him reigned another called Apachnas, 36 years and 7 months. After him, Apophis reigned 61 years, and then Jonias, 50 years. You gotta talk into this thing.
Apophis was one of the folks from Ankian and Lil's group from Nibiru.
So he was a galactic.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. The plot thickens, everybody. After all, these reigned Assis, A-S-S-I-S, 49 years and 2 months. After all these reigned Assis 49 years and 2 months. Quote, and these six were the first rulers among them, who were all along making war with the Egyptians, and were very desirous gradually to destroy them to the very roots. This whole nation was styled Hyksos, H-Y-C-S-O-S. That is shepherd kings, for the first syllable, H-Y-C, according to the sacred dialect, denotes a king, as is S-O-S, a shepherd. Yet this according to the ordinary dialect, and of these is compounded Hyksos, H-Y-C-S-O-S. Yet some say that these people were Arabians, these people whom we have before named kings and called shepherds also, and their descendants kept possession of Egypt 511 years. So spoke an ancient Egyptian priest who had seen Egypt's records of history. I saw the name Salatis, and immediately the Hebrew king Saul stood up in my mind. Even the second king that the Egyptian priest had named appeared to match what biblical writers had preserved about the second king of the Hebrews, King David, who was said to have ruled for more than 40 years. There was, however, a problem with the belief that Saul was Salatis. I had noticed that a Bible passage stated that Saul ruled for 40 years. My body froze when I remember that Egypt's own record placed Salatis on the throne for only 13 years. This is where Secret Places of the Lion explains things. It's Amosa the First and King David, they body hopped, and then it kept on going. Very, very interesting. We got to go back and read some more of that. Okay, a search through records about Saul showed there was a long-standing controversy about how long Saul actually ruled. It seemed that the ancient record was torn or worn, where the number of years for Saul's reign was written. That record said that Saul was one when he began to rule, and that he ruled for more years after killing another ruler. For the number of years that Saul ruled as king after killing the other king, the old record showed the number two. Yet a number that was before the two was missing from the record. Scholars could only guess at what number was written before the two, making it uncertain whether Saul ruled as king for 12, 22, 32, or even 42 years. I saw an answer to the dilemma. Saul ruled for 1 year as king of the Hebrews only. After killing the Egyptian king, Saul became a ruler of Egypt as well. He reigned for 12 years as king of a part of Egypt. The Egyptian priest had clearly explained that the Hyksos kings replaced the Egyptian king and ruled Egypt. Saul's reign as king of the Hebrews for 1 year, then as king of Egypt for 12 years, would bring Saul's reign to 13 years, just as the Egyptian priest had seen written in the Egyptian records under the name Salatis. Again, this was too simple, and biblical scholars were too educated not to have noticed these things. How had they missed seeing this? Maybe they had missed it. Maybe they looked a bit deeper into the record and saw the next thing that I saw. And that's the end of chapter 30, so the mystery will remain until next week. And I pass this long-stemmed lavender rainbow, Excalibur, emerald green, serpent-feathered, Quetzalcoatl talking stick to my sister Rain Bird.
I'll take that talking stick. Thank you. Oh, and tonight I want to read about horse in medicine books. So we are in this year of the green horse. And number 35 represents power. And 35 is an 8, and we're in an 8 Mayan year as well. So I think that's an interesting synchronicity. First, there's this poem. Mighty horse. Power to run across the open plain, or to bring the vision of a shield dancing in purple dream rain. Stealing horses is stealing power was a statement made frequently in historical Native America and a reference to the esteemed role which horse played in the Native culture. force is physical power and unearthly power. In shamanic practices throughout the world, force enables shamans to fly through the air and reach heaven. Humanity made a great leap when horse was domesticated, a discovery akin to that of fire. Before horse, humans were earthbound, heavy laden, and slow creatures indeed. Once humans climbed on horses' back, they were as free and fleet as the wind. They could carry burdens for great distances with ease. Through their special relationship with horse, humans altered their self-concept beyond measure. Horse was the first animal medicine of civilization. Humanity owes its incalculable debt to horse and to the new medicine that it brought. It would be a long walk to see one's brother or sister if horse had not welcomed the two-legged rider upon its back. Today we measure the capacity of engines with the term horsepower, a reminder of the days when horse was an honored and highly prized partner with humanity. Dreamwalker, a medicine man, was walking across the plains to visit the Arapaho Nation. He carried with him his pipe, the feather tied into his long black hair pointed to the ground, marking him as a man of peace. Over the rise of a hill, Dreamwalker saw a herd of wild mustangs running towards him. Black Stallion approached him and asked if he was seeking an answer on his journey. Black Stallion said, "I am from the void where answer lives, right on my back, and know the power of entering the darkness and finding the light." Dreamwalker thanked Black Stallion and agreed to visit him when his medicine was needed in the dream time. Yellow Stallion approached Dreamwalker next and offered to take him to the east, where illumination lived. Dreamwalker could share the answers he found there to teach and illuminate others. Once again, Dreamwalker thanked Yellow Stallion and said he would use these gifts of power on his journey. Red Stallion approached, rearing playfully. He told Dreamwalker of the joys of balancing work and heavy medicine with the joyful experiences of play. He reminded Dreamwalker that he could better hold the attention of those he taught when humor was integrated with the lesson. Dreamwalker thanked him and promised to remember the gift of joy. Dreamwalker was nearing his destination. The Arapaho Nation was close at hand. White Stallion came to the front of the herd. Dreamwalker mounted White Stallion's back. White Stallion was the message carrier for all the other horses and represented wisdom and power. This magnificent horse was the embodiment of the balanced medicine shield. "No abuse of power will ever lead to wisdom," said White Stallion. "You, Dreamwalker, have made this journey to heal a brother in need, to share the sacred pipe, and to heal the Mother Earth. You have the knowledge through humility that you are an instrument of great spirit. As I carry you upon my back, you carry the needs of the people on yours. In wisdom, you understand that power is not given lightly, but awarded to those who are willing to carry responsibility in a balanced manner." Dreamwalker, the shaman, had been healed by the visit of the wild horses and knew that his purpose in coming to the Arapaho was to share these gifts with them. In understanding the power of horse, you may see how to strive for a balanced medicine shield. True power is wisdom found in remembering your total journey. Wisdom comes from remembering pathways that you have walked in another person's moccasins. Compassion, caring, teaching, loving, and sharing your gifts, talents, and abilities are the gateways to power. So lots of gratitude from Jamie Sams and you, Tara and Mama, and for all of you who show up each and every week, and or for the good music, Mama.
All right, and thank you, sister. That's very interesting. Thank you for reading Horse Medicine. And you know, the number 8 is the number of the return of the Christ, the cosmic Christ, the Kalki Maitreya, the 10th incarnation, the Mahdi. So let's put that in our pipe and smoke it as we read this, as we listen to this beautiful prophecy song from our sister, Joanne Shenandoah.
Thank you.
This was just the most beautiful thing that she had the trail of tears, and then she went into how the Mohawks, the part of the she's Iroquois, and so the message, I mean they learned how to use guns, and they got on their horses and they went. And they went and they said, we're not going to let this slaughter take place. And they fought back. And so they're, oops, you went too far. Go back. I want to read these 10 Native American commandments that she put up here. There. Okay. Okay. Stop it. Stop it. Okay. The Native American 10 commandments. Number one, treat the earth and all that dwell therein with respect. Two, remain close to the Great Spirit. Three, show great respect for your fellow beings. Four, work together for the benefit of all mankind. Five, give assistance and kindness wherever needed. Six, do what you know to be right. Seven, look after the well-being of mind and body. Eight, dedicate a share of your efforts to the greater good. Nine, be truthful and honest at all times. 10, take the full responsibility for your actions. We're going to have to put those things down. What a beautiful set of 10 commandments. And this is why they say that the red man shall lead. And that's why it's the song of Into the West. And on that note, let us stay true to our hearts and souls and know that the power of our unity in consciousness together is the power of full total complete transformation of this planet in the twinkling of an eye, as it has been promised. And do not leave anything to your imagination that cannot be done. It is so, and so be it. And inshallah, everyone, and come to Cheryl's calls. It's 213-342-3000. And the pin code is 946-7441#. And then, is this next Tuesday, is Ashtar on the road again? That's right, on the road again. So we'll see you now in the bridge of the river, of the river of the light, of the rainbow bridge, Satnam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Aho Mitakuyasana.